Welcome to DC Special Cast, a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Paul Ken. This podcast is an exploration of DC's special comics of the Bronze Age, which included such titles as the aptly named DC Special and DC Special Series, but also DC Superstars, Super DC Giant, Four-Star Superhero Spectacular, and others. If you've read any of these comics, you know that they varied wildly in content, quality, and even format. They featured every possible genre of the comics industry at the time. We are going full sci-fi this month, covering DC Superstars number 16, The Star Hunters. And to help me, I've got a great guest, Mike Atchison from Mike's Comics Roadshow Podcast and Campix Comics Cast. Hey, Mike, welcome to DC Special Cast.
Well, thanks a bunch, Paul. You've had such great guests so far. I really feel like that I am actually starstruck to be included in their company. Thank you very much. I've been a listener since you began. In fact, I emailed you, I think, as soon as you announced the premise for this podcast, because it's right in my, I don't know if I'd say wheelhouse, but it's a very specific interest of mine in comics.
That's awesome. Well, I want to hear all about that. Yeah, tell me about, you know, your secret origin with comics or how you're interested in some of these titles that I cover.
Well, when you reach a certain vintage such as mine, and we've discussed that already before we recorded, but it can be kind of a long story, but it all boils down to when I was maybe 7 or 8 years old, I had an uncle that worked at World Color Press in Sparta, Illinois, and he brought me and my cousins, me, my brother, and my cousins, stacks of comics. If he didn't bring them directly to us, he'd drop them off at my grandma's and they would be there. And it would be just like a magical experience. What new stuff were we going to get at this point? It was every few months. For those that don't know, World Color Press, if you look at the indicia on any comic from, say, the 60s till the 90s, they were all printed right there in Sparta, Illinois, at least U.S. comics. I lived about 20 miles away. I truly think that my cousin or someone had access to what Uncle Flap, that was his name, brought home and picked out all the Marvel comics, because I never got any Marvel comics. And that's how I became so adhered to and so attached to DC Comics. It's just because that's what I cut my teeth on. And literally, we'd go camping in the summer and I'd take these comics with me and I'd started my own collection at home. And it just became a thing. And as I grew and had my own independent financial resources, you know, whether from putting up hay or mowing grass, I found these ads for Mile High Comics and I started buying back issues, especially Justice League, because that was my thing. Yeah, and when I get to stay in town at my grandma's, I would ride my little Huffy BMX bike, ride it up to the grocery store and get comics or just see what was on the rack and hope there's something that connected to the last month's rack helping.
You always had the hope, right?
Yes.
We hear lots of stories, and Rob talks about it a lot, but other people do too, about how, you know, distribution was so sporadic. I was pretty lucky growing up in New Jersey that I, most of the time, you know, the comics got a regular distribution of most of the issues that I wanted. You never were guaranteed, but if you didn't go in on a regular basis, then of course you could miss it, but, you know, because they'd send them back. But yeah, I used to help one of the stores when I got a little older. He would let me, you know, day early go in and I could snip the cords off and pick out the issues I wanted before he put them up on the stand. So yeah, when I was like junior high or something, that got kind of age, I got to do that for a while. So that was always fun.
Oh, that's cool.
All right, so before we get much farther, I do want to take a moment to thank our sponsors. This episode of DC Special Cast is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStock Trades is your best online source for trades, hardcovers, and other collected editions, all for up to 40% off with free shipping for orders of $50 or more. So Mike, what'd you bring?
I'll tell you, I had to find something that Michelinie wrote. That was my big thing. I wanted to find something he wrote, and I found Venom, The Saga of Eddie Brock. And mostly because the creator or co-creator of Venom was David Michelinie, a co-creator of Venom. I like the idea of this character, and I have know very little about him. And I thought, I'm going to actually make a recommendation of something that I'm going to buy for sure. So it features a great cover by Alex Ross. It's 192 pages and it collects Amazing Spider-Man, the original 1963 volume, numbers 300, 315 through 317. So it's not like an overwhelming amount of obligation there. It gets you a nice origin story of a pretty cool character.
Awesome. Well, I brought another one written by Dave Michelinie, Iron Man Armor Wars Omnibus. Tony Stark goes to war in three epic conflicts sparked by his greatest technology of all, the Iron Man armor. So he teamed up with Bob Layton, a lot of these. Mark Bright was a penciler. Layton was his co-plotter and the inker. This one has a ton of stuff in it. It's got 768 pages, Iron Man 219 to 232, 258 to 266, and the Armor Wars miniseries. All that for $100, but if at in stock trades, it was $65. You save 35%. All right, let's get into the issue we want to talk about today. This is DC Superstars number 16, starring the Star Hunters. It has a cover date of September, October 1977. Was on sale on June 30th, 1977. So almost 1 month to the day after the release of a little movie known as Star Wars. 60 cents cover price, 48 pages, edited by Joe Orlando. To the best of my knowledge, this issue and the rest of the Star Hunter series, which followed, has never been reprinted, nor is it on DC Universe Infinite. So Mike, I assume you have a physical copy. Have you read the entire Star Hunter series? What made you interested? Like you did, as you mentioned, you jumped out right at a very early time saying, hey, I want to do this when it comes time around to do Star Hunters. Give me some background here, man.
I have my collection. It's the standard sorting by publisher and then alphabetical numerical. For some reason, I read Rima the Jungle Girl, which I discussed with Professor Allen on the
Quarterback. A great series.
Yes. And I got this whim. I thought, all right, I want to put all of my non-superhero DC and non-horror, non-war as well, but basically sci-fi, fantasy, noir, jungle, adventure, whatever, into one small box or two. One of the first series that I read.
By the way, a worthy endeavor. There's some great gems in there. I'm with you.
And I think I was laid up with, I just had surgery. So I was like, okay, I want something I can really sink my teeth in. Anyway, I read Star Hunters and I started with number one. Wait a second. Why am I thinking that's not the first one that I remember? Then I looked up and found out that, this was sort of debuted. I don't know if it's so much a pilot because it was just like 1 month before the series. They'd already made the commitment. Yeah. But it was in DC Superstars number 16. And so I dug it out. I read it first. Then I read the next, what was it, seven issues. Yeah, and I loved it. Everything from Spanner's Galaxy to Sonic Disruptors, crazy stuff like that in the 80s. I haven't read everything yet, but I think I had another shiny object that took me away from it. And I still have the boxes separated, but I do plan to get to it.
This is a cool book. It's a shame. Make a nice little trade, eight, nine issues. You could easily see this being a little trade, as many of these other ones. Like you could put Rima in a trade or some of these other ones would be pretty cool. But I don't know how commercial it is, unfortunately. So, what are you going to do?
Yeah.
From a Wayne special investment standpoint, this book runs, $4, maybe $10, depending on condition. I saw a listing on eBay for this plus all seven of the regular series for $40 if anybody wants to read the whole series, which I'll say I have not done. You may have inspired me to go seek out these other ones if I can find them at a show. This would be the kind of thing I would only try to buy sort of in person and in the $2 bins or less because just as a fun thing to do. And that might be hard to do because it'd be hard to find because they don't always bring.
Well, after everybody hears this episode, they're all going to
buy. Well, that's true. Sean always likes to say that when we talk about things like this, it's hard to find these things afterwards. So what are you going to do? We're responsible for the Richie Rich Renaissance, I think, too.
There you go. That's true. So,
I did see somebody trying to get $138 for a CGC 9.6 of this, which you got to be a big Don Newton fan, I think, you just want this on your wall or something. I don't know why somebody would pay that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't mind if I feel like it's a good investment buy, I could be persuaded, but without something external driving the price, like a movie or a TV series, I probably wouldn't drop a chunk of change like that.
The reason to get this book is to read it, I think.
Right, yeah. I'm not much of a slab. I've only bought a handful of graded books, and that was because I didn't know if I'd ever get a chance to buy them otherwise. So
I like them. I have a few Golden Age and some of the quality Silver Age things. And if you are buying online, I've been burned by condition and stuff in the past.
For sure.
That's the main reason why they started it. It's now a thing of its own. But anyway, that's not here or there. All right. So this month, June 1977, according to Mike's Amazing World, some great books. For DC, we had Detective number 472, another part of the Englehart Rogers run, where, and this one was where Hugo Strange plays it being Batman. Great, great run. We have also have DC Special Series number one, Five-Star Superhero Spectacular, which I covered with Ryan Daly last year. That is kind of the series that replaced, right, DC Superstars and DC Special. You know, why have all these miscellaneous ones? And they sort of started lumping everything in the special series. But I would get in big trouble if I didn't mention Batman Family number 13, which is my podcast partner Sean M. Meyer's favorite issue, I think favorite comic of all time. And that was the one, of course, with the triple team up of Robin, Batgirl, and Man-Bat. And over at Marvel, we had Champions number 15 with art by John Byrne, and Amazing Spider-Man Annual number 11, which I've mentioned before, which had the first published art of John Romita Jr. in the backup story. How about you, Mike? Anything jump out at you?
Yes, a lot. And I'll try to restrain myself. But first, I want to comment. I was cursing Ryan Daly when I seen he had already, when I looked at your list of prospective coverage, and I seen five-star superhero spectacular with that awesome Neil Adams cover. Yeah. I'm like, oh, man. But another great feature here. I mean, I say feature in the way of your podcast episodes and on Mike's Amazing World, but it is like traveling back through time. So in 1977, I was 11, smack dab in my proverbial comics golden age. Yeah. And I had my own income. And like I said earlier, I'd mow grass. I'd ride my bike up to the drugstore, or I might be getting some free ones from my uncle. I definitely remember this iconic Batman number 291 with the Jim Aparo cover and the Batman Rogues Gallery standing over his grave. That is emblazoned in my brain. I also likely bought All-Star Comics 68 because I know I think I got a couple, the early ones free from my uncle. And then I was like, okay, I got to keep buying these. Brave and the Bold 136, Flash 253 with that great buckler cover. As a lifelong Justice League fan, I most certainly bought Justice League of America number 146, where Hawkgirl finally joins the JLA.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, this is just full of stuff that if I didn't buy it, I recognized it. You know, the Secret Society of Supervillains, issue 9, which featured one of my favorite characters, the Creeper, and then Superboy and the Legion of Superheroes, which I know I was picking up off the rack monthly as well. They all just resonate strongly with me. I almost want to just go back in time and just re-experience it for the first time.
As we've said many times, my favorite website, the newsstand feature is just God's gift to podcasters, that's for sure. So,
yeah, for sure.
All right, back to the comics. Mike, would you like to describe the cover and comment on it? Of course, by Don Newton and Bob Layton.
Well, sure. The Starner's team is very much in the foreground of this cover. They are not so much forward charging as they are sort of forward escaping this gaping hole in the spaceship's hull and the enemy fire in the background. So Donovan Flint, he's holding the unconscious Darcy Vale, which is contrary to her personality. She is not a damsel in distress character.
Yeah.
But for cover purposes, he's got her and he's in one arm and he's hanging onto some kind of a cable with the other hand to avoid being sucked out into space. And then you got Jake Hammersmith, Dr. Sellers, Mindiano, and Dr. McGavin all flailing about, also trying to avoid being sucked into space. And then above it all, you have the Star Hunters logo, which I found online. I don't know if it's been confirmed, but Neil Adams designed it. I didn't know if he did much logo design. Could be AI hallucination. I don't know.
We'll have to ask our resident logo expert, Martin Gray. One of the things I noticed is that on the first page, they clearly didn't have the logo when Don Newton was penciling, because if you look on the splash page, which we'll get to in a minute, the logo inside is horrible. This one is much better.
Yeah.
It's a very striking logo. Not the most unique or unusual logos, but it's a very good one. But the one inside is pretty bad.
Yeah, it definitely looks freehand and looks like something maybe a junior high art student might try to put together, but maybe they were in a hurry.
Yeah, no, I love the cover too. DC Superstars often had a little band on the top. We don't have the DC Bullet yet, which is coming soon because Jeanette Kahn is on board. But we do have DC Superstars Presents, an all-new double-length space adventure. So they're letting you know that for your 60 cents, you're getting a double-length. That was her thing, right? She wanted higher price points to get better rack space so that the merchants would make more profit. They would therefore promote more DC Comics, the whole theory behind dollar comics, all the rest of them. I do like that this is a scene that's in the comic.
Yep.
That's great. I think it pops. I think Darcy's outfit being that purple or pinkish red, whatever color that is, I think pops against the rest of the landscape. So I think it's a great cover.
Yeah, that's true. I hadn't thought about the color composition, but I think the whole the scene itself gives you the feel of a high stakes space adventure. I mean, and plus, I don't think you can say go too far into this description without saying swashbuckling, because that's they are space swashbucklers. At least Donovan Flint is.
You get that right from this. I agree with you. You get it right from it. Yeah,
Yeah,
yeah.
he could just as easily be, hanging from a what's the even the
The
terms on a
mast of a ship
the
and
mast of a
swing you
ship.
down.
Yes.
Yeah. That's a great point. Same pose.
Yeah. I want to comment on Don Newton overall. He was one of my favorite Bronze Age artists, and it was kind of short-lived, but it seemed like he could really adapt to any type of story, whether it be a Captain Marvel Shazam story or Batman story. The muscularity of his figures all throughout are just is exemplified here on the cover. The facial structures are very strong.
And unique, different. Every character looks like a different person. And
Yes.
that we've remarked on before, done a number of different Don Newton stories. And I think he's great, taken much too early, unfortunately.
Yeah.
I think he's terrific. So I agree with you. All right. Of course, I will post the cover, plenty of other pages from this comic on the gallery page for DC Special Cast at fireandwaterpodcast.com. So the title of our story, if we flip the page, is called The Farrell Alternative. It's a 34-pager. It's written by David Michelinie, as we've mentioned, and penciled by Don Newton with ink by Bob Layton. Now, one of the things we'll say, if anybody's cringing out there, I've always said Michelinie as his last name. I've heard people say Michelinie, like the tire. I think when I was a little kid, I probably said that because the Michelin Man tires were
Same.
on TV. But I think it's Michelinie. If anybody knows definitively, please let us know in the comments. All right. So let's just get that out of the way right now. So I don't get comments about that's not how you say it. So anyway. All right. So, Mike, would you like to do the honors and summarize the story for our listeners?
Yes, of course. Okay, we open our tale as we are introduced to Donovan Flint, swashbuckler. He stops some pirates from stealing food from a farming asteroid. As the food lands back on Earth, he meets Darcy Vale, who is managing the process for the corporation. They don't get along very well. Darcy then breaks a lunch date with Charles Bane, since she has been summoned by Director Farrell of the corporation to an important meeting. She disses Bane to her roommate as boring, but high up in the corporation. Meanwhile, Flint has been out carousing and is observed by that same Director Farrell. Farrell summons Flint to his office the next morning, but it is a trap. Flint is knocked unconscious, and when he recovers, Farrell tells him that his next assignment is to find the other half of an ancient Sornay artifact, which supposedly holds the secret to a civilization which seeded life throughout the galaxy. Flint is not impressed and is about to walk out when Farrell drops the bomb on him while he was unconscious. Flint was subjected to a procedure that is rearranging his cellular structure and will kill him if he remains on Earth. However, in space, the stellar radiation reverses the effect. He needs to take this job from the corporation in order to stay alive and if he ever wants to obtain a cure. He tries to attack Farrell but is once again felled by a guard, and when he wakes up, he is in outer space. Flint is on the Sunrider, a ship that is equipped for long, deep space missions. To his chagrin, he finds that he is not the commander of the ship. Darcy Vale is. He also meets the other members of the crew: Bruce Sellers, the ship's doctor; Mindy Yao, timid computer technician and electrician; Dr. McGavin, presumably science, but who tries unsuccessfully to escape since he has a family at home; and Jake Hammersmith, who appears to be the muscle and who happens to already know Flint. The crew sets off on their mission, and we end part one on an ominous note as Farrell reports in to the chairman of the corporation that they know nothing of their real mission. That chairman is Charles Bane. Part two kicks off with an argument between Flint and Darcy, which almost turns deadly as the crew faces an attack from a Guardian drone. Despite sealing a hull breach, the drone continues to pursue them. Darcy has an idea that if they can get aboard the drone, they can deactivate it. Flint is ready to do his heroic stuff, but Darcy points out that he would not have the necessary computer experience. So Darcy orders Mindy Yao to spacewalk over to the drone. After some space maneuvering, she is able to neutralize the drone and get back to the Sunrider before the drone explodes. We end our story as the group realizes that they are on this adventure together. They need to work collaboratively if they are going to accomplish their mission and survive. The end.
Mike, what did you think of this story overall? If you read this, would you want to go pick up the other issues when they came out?
Oh, yes, way more than average books that are introducing a new team, a new concept, a new storyline. This has a good hook. It's got a good premise in the plot line with this team having to be together. It has a variety of different personalities that are played up fairly well. There's a little bit sketchy science, but
Yeah.
hey, it's comics and you know,
Comic
it,
science, yeah.
yeah, right. So no, I would have definitely been looking for the next issue in whatever comic it came in. I would be wanting to read the continuing story.
Thought it was exciting. It's a good premise. You could tell Michelinie's a Star Trek fan. They set it up so they have the people in the different roles on the ship, but things are mixed up in a different way, which will create interesting things. And I'll be honest with you, I had this special when I was a kid, but I never bought the other issues. And I don't remember why, because I read it now and I'm like, I don't know why I wouldn't have wanted to buy this because I really enjoyed it. You know what I mean? I hadn't read this for years. And I'm like, why didn't I buy this when I was a kid? I don't know.
I don't know if it's because Star Hunters, maybe some shops, at least in my hometown, I don't know that they would have said, I don't know who that is or what that is. We're not going to put that on the rack quite yet or order it for the rack. But
Like I said, I usually have pretty good luck with distribution. I tend to think it was a choice, but I don't know. I can't remember. All right, so let's go through what's nice about this. There is a decent amount of scenes that breaks up the story pretty well that we can walk through. But on the splash page, we get a solo shot of Donovan Flint, the leader of the Star Hunters, the terrible logo, as I mentioned. He's standing very heroically, and there's spaceships and a moon and the stars and some sort of menacing looking robot thing behind him. Great piece of art. Doesn't tell you much about the story, but I do like the splash page. I don't know what you think about it.
Yeah, I do. I like it. He's sort of a pirate with an Irish accent, you know, that Irish brogue, and he's in a sort of a Flash Gordon heroic pose holding the ray guns. And yeah, he fits the model, and it's a great introductory page.
Yep. The first scene is set on this asteroid. Three pages. You get these pirates and they're hijacking. Apparently, food is grown on asteroids. So here's your first sci-fi concept that food is grown on asteroids and imported back to Earth for people to eat, right? And so he breaks up this ring of smugglers. Bottom of page two, you get a great sneering look by one of the bad guys. He's about to like kill one of the farm people. Great Don Newton art on this. And then you get the entrance of Flint, who takes him out pretty easily. And I have to say, the coolest thing is his guns that are on the back of his wrist that flip out and phew, you can almost imagine the phew, like almost like Spider-Man would do is, but he just flips his wrist out and these guns like pop into his hand. It's hard to describe. I'll put that page in the thing, but I thought that was super cool.
It's almost as if they had a licensing agreement with some toy manufacturer to put little toy ray gun accessories to do something like that. Yeah, I could see myself at that age, at 11 or so, taping some plastic guns and see if I could flip it over and use it. Yeah.
We are miming the action, as the Earth 2 guys say, for the benefit of our YouTube viewers.
Yeah.
I love how all the apples fall on this guy's head at the end, kind of like
Yeah.
the tribbles falling on Captain Kirk.
Yeah, again, Newton shows ingenuity in his design, his storytelling. Then on page three, you can feel the pain when Donovan Flint is given that sort of uppercut with that's like a big gun, but he's
Yeah.
using it as a bludgeon
Ooh.
on the bad guy and hitting him in the chin. I'm like, oh my gosh,
Ouch.
that had to hurt quite a bit. I'm impressed.
So then we cut back to Earth and we meet the efficient, all-seeing eyes of Ms. Darcy Vale, who's in charge of the shipment for the corporation, which apparently the corporation runs everything on Earth. And that's, another sci-fi concept that, here we go. There's a nebulous, is it evil corporation running everything on Earth? She gets pissed at Donovan because he chomps an apple, which I thought was great. It shows the personalities right there.
Yeah, I think the concept of this big corporation having so much power sort of resonates in this day and age when you see a handful of big companies having so much concentration of power. So it's sort of prescient to this story or this concept here.
Amazing, 50 years ago. And so we get this interchange with Flint and Darcy. She's like, "You got to toe the line." He's like, "I just saved all this food. I'm going to do what I want." He finishes the apple because I just think the apple bit is funny. And then we get Darcy having a Zoom call with her date, this Charles Dane, who seems very meek and has a rock and roll record collection, which is like, she's like, oh, can you imagine rock and roll in this day and age, which is funny. And she says to her friend or roommate or whoever is like, oh, he's kind of a dud, but he's high up in the corporation. So, she's working her way up the corporate ladder, I suppose. I don't know.
They played up his what's the word, weeniness so much that you're like, okay, there's this guy's got to be something different later in the story.
Yeah,
So,
exactly.
the rock and roll collection caught my eye as well.
Thought that was funny. So then we get a scene where we get the roguishness, right? I don't know if you want to describe this next scene in the bar.
I think this is the carousing part of our synopsis here, where he's sort of hanging out with a woman and trying to impress her with his souvenirs that he has back at the apartment. He's being eyeballed by a couple of baddies, and they pick a fight with him. And he makes somewhat short work with them, but it turns out that that's all just to test his talents, so to speak, because these guys were hired by Director Farrell, I suppose, right?
You see them talking to Farrell on the way out, and then Farrell reports in to the chairman of the corporation, whom we don't know who that is yet, and says, yep, he will do quite nicely as our next recruit. So then we get something that's a little bit risque for a 1977 comic book, right? Where we wake up and Donovan's in his apartment, and the woman who has spent the night, she's in his nightshirt, making him eggs in the morning. He's lying in bed and he gets a call from the corporation saying, you got to come and meet with Director Farrell, right away. Come now. So I don't know what you thought about that.
Okay, so again, Newton's art is being shown off, or the back muscles of this guy, Flint, is really shown off. It's not only a bit risque for the time, but it's also a little bit, of course, the woman is in there frying the eggs for him, making him breakfast the next morning. It's,
Very Captain Kirk.
yes, exactly. So, yeah, I do want to go back real quick to when Flint is trying to impress this woman at the bar. He's mentions that he had a gadget from Regulus. Well, it's actually spelled Regulius 4 on one spot, and then later it's spelled Regulus 4. And I was like, why do I recognize that? Is that one of the fictional space planets in DC? Turns out I was thinking of Dr. Regulus, the Legion of Superheroes villain. So yeah, that threw me. You know how things catch your eye and you're like, oh, is there a connection? And sometimes you just make a connection where there's not one. So, but yeah, the morning after scene was interesting and of its time, I suppose.
He goes to the meeting with Farrell. He is ushered into a room which traps him and knocks him out with a sonic sound has no substance. So the sonic wall that batters the startled adventurer has no form and no tangibility. But he passes out and then is taken in to meet with Farrell. And so Farrell describes this mission. You want to talk about the mission a little bit?
Basically, trying to appeal to him without using any leverage at first. And of course, being kidnapped after being assaulted, Flint's not really going for it. But then it turns out that Farrell has to use the fact that he subjected him to these sonic waves, which changed his molecular structure. I'm sure Neil deGrasse Tyson would maybe not agree with that premise or that idea. But it's all because Farrell's explaining in a whole page of exposition here that there is this Sornay alien language. So I guess I can be forgiven for mispronouncing it if it is mispronounced. Sornay artifact relic recently found on a frontier world. It's one half of it. And the symbols tell part of a story that this civilization had gone around all of the different planets in the galaxy and seeded it with life, including Earth. So it's all some big science expedition, but you have to imagine that the corporation is seeing some financial gain if Flint's team finds the other half. Oh, well, that's what he says right here. He actually says the reason they're going for it is for security because the corporation has ruled the planet since the Panic of 93. I don't know if that's 1993 or later.
2093.
Anyway, the idea is that they want that other half of the artifact. They want more information. Information is power. And they are forcing Flint, and we'll soon find out another, the whole team to do it.
No, it's interesting. You got to scratch your head. Like, what do they really want with this thing? We're clearly not being told the whole story. The facial expressions of Flint when he finds like his arm is starting to decompose or turn, it's kind of like green
Oh, my
scaly.
sweet soul, in my non-Irish accent.
His dialogue is pretty funny, I have to admit. So Flint freaks out and goes to attack them, but is tasered by one of the guards and is knocked out yet again. This is the second time he's knocked out in the first 16 pages. And he wakes up on a ship. Page 16 is pretty neat. You get this sort of Kirby Crackle space outpost, a lot of shading. Director Farrell is there with Donovan. They're in like a shuttlecraft. They're going to the Sunrider spaceship. So this is their version of the Enterprise. Flynn is first pretty impressed with the ship. They've got plants growing there. They've got the star drive. And he says, will you reconsider? He says, well, since I don't have a much of a choice, I'll be your commander. He's like, you don't understand. You're not the commander. You're the troubleshooter. The commander is, and they open the door, and there's Darcy Vale. And so I thought that was a good reveal. What about you?
Great. It's perfect. To me, it's great contrast from that previous scene with the woman that was in his apartment, with a strong woman with a commanding presence, and she definitely proves her merit later on. That page you mentioned is page 16.
Yeah.
I'm not an art collector, but if I were, this would be a page I think I would like for that, the reasons you gave, you know, the Kirby Crackle sort of space cloud, the design of the CSV Sunrider. It's beautiful. It's very moody. I love that.
Yeah, it's a great page. I agree.
What does CSV stand for?
Corporation Space Vehicle was the best I could come up with.
Okay.
But I don't know. I don't think we're told.
Yeah, okay. Well, I thought maybe it's something that I'm just not up on my science fiction enough to know.
Yeah. I assume the C stands for corporation, you know, and then SV, I'm just making that up, space vehicle, but who knows?
Yeah.
All right, so then we meet the rest of the team. Do you want to run through the rest of the team and their roles and what we know about them?
Yeah, sure. The first one that we are introduced to is basically, it's an interesting way because, you know, there's a little bit of an argument between Flint and Darcy Vale, and the big guy, Jake Hammersmith, which is a great name, by the way, he kind of grabs Flint and calls, say, hey, Donnie boy. And Jake, he says, you old space dog. I mean, that's what I'm going to say to my friend when I see him later today. So, hey, buddy, you old space dog. But yeah, so it's kind of a reunion for those two guys. Hammersmith is a big guy, big, bulky guy. And he's got one of these mutton chops that connect to a mustache. I'm not sure if there's a special name for that, but it's distinct, and which is great. And then we're barely introduced to Dr. Bruce Sellers. He's the bones of the group. And Ms. Mindiano, computer technician and master electrician. And Dr. McGavin, where Director Farrell is trying to introduce him, but he's trying to escape on the shuttle pod to get back to Earth because he does not want to leave his family. Can't blame the guy. He's stopped by Flint. Yeah, so there's our team. Like I said, there's enough diversity and talent, and it just gives you ideas that this could be a lot of fun to read further stuff.
It's great. They got the roles of the different characters. It's slightly different what's on Star Trek, but there's a bridge crew, right? And so This is the team. And so that's a pretty good introduction. The last page of part one, page 20, you can see this could have been an issue, right? It could have been a single issue because We end up where we find out that
the weenie
takes Farrell takes off in the shuttlecraft. He contacts the director of the corporation. Says they don't have any idea of their true mission, and so we're good to go. He's got this evil grin on his face, and we find out that Charles Bane, the weenie guy, as you say, is in fact the head of the corporation and the big bad. I mean, that would have been a good place to end. That's a pretty good ending for an issue, if you ask me.
Yeah, very good hook.
Then we get to start at part two. Part two has its own title, Beyond the Solar Rim, which doesn't tell us a whole lot, but we do get another cool shot of the Sunrider in space. Sunrider's sort of like, they got all kinds of things sticking out from it. It does not as sleek as the Enterprise, but it's got things sticking out of it, antennas and stuff. So it's pretty neat. I'll include that picture of it.
When you're looking at it, you can see the influence of the Enterprise, but it's just different enough. I'm not sure what those antennas are, or if they're big guns or what they are, but I think the design's pretty good.
Yeah, and it's cool you got a rocket exhaust. Like, you don't have the nacelles that do the warp drive on the Enterprise. The rocket is clearly powering the thrust of the vehicle.
Right.
So then the first scene we get in part two is very exciting scene where Darcy and Flint are arguing, telling him, hey, I'm the commander, and this is the way we go. He's like, no, I just changed the course because we don't want to run into these Guardian drones. And she's like, I'm in charge here. We're going to go the way I want to go. And then, of course, they're attacked by a Guardian drone, and we have the decompression and the scene, essentially, from the cover where he's holding on to the cable. He doesn't save Darcy. In fact, she saves the crew.
Yeah, the only thing that's exactly right is that he's hanging on to a cable, which is, by the way, a live wire. And it's really a scene of chaos, the drone blasting this hole in the hull, and they're trying to keep from being sucked out to space. Flint almost does get pulled out, but he is saved by I can't remember which one of the crew. It's not Hammersmith. Well, it is. Maybe it is
I
Hammersmith.
think it is
Yeah.
Hammersmith.
He grabs him. Oh, and then the shirt starts to rip, and then Darcy is the one that saves the day. She uses her smarts to swing over and kick the life-saving something that every ship needs, the emergency sealer.
What I like about this is Flint is halfway out the hole and they're holding on to him by his arms. And then the emergency sealer is like closing the hole and it would like chop
Oh,
him in
yeah.
half if they don't suck him back in, which I think is really cool. Now, again, this is some comic book science here. I like the fact it's an emergency sealer. It's different than shields, right? Which is fine. It's sort of closing like this fluid metal, right? And it's closing up the hole. Now that they would take a lot of power to pull him back in if the air is still rushing out. That's going to be hard to do. But they do. They get him back in before he's chopped in half. And of course, he's shirtless now. So now he can be heroic. But the scene at the bottom of 24 where Darcy flips around the chair is just a great action sequence by Don Newton where she flips around and kicks that emergency sealer. I think that's terrific. I enjoyed this scene quite a bit.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I don't know if you noticed, but on page 25, that middle panel, whenever Flint says, "I suppose 'twould be a bit trite to say that was close," he's looking at, I think, his boot. His boot got caught in the hole when it closed up.
Oh, you're right. I didn't know what that was. That is his boot. Good catch. That's pretty funny.
So, yeah, that
Yes,
was
because at the
definitely
bottom of
close.
that page, he doesn't have his shoe on. You can see his bare foot at the bottom of the shoe, and the doctor's checking him out. Very cool. Very cool.
I don't know if that was Michelinie's idea or if that was Newton's, but it was a nice little added plus.
But what's cool here is they're not out of danger yet. Now they're being fired upon again by this drone. Flint tells him it's no good, Missy. That automated devil's a pursuit drone. It's programmed to follow a target till its target's destroyed. And its hull is too thick that even our most advanced armament can't get through it. They don't know how they're going to defeat him, but Darcy knows. And she says, if we can't do it from outside, we have to do it from inside and reprogram the drone. I thought this sequence was interesting. She just happens to have the answer, but that happens in all these stories and a lot of Star Trek stories. Some of, Spock or Data just happens to have the answer. And he's like, all right, I'll go over and do it. She's like, you don't know anything about computers, dummy. And I got to send Mindy over. So he sends over Mindy Yano. She's like, I've never been even been in space before. So I thought this sequence was great. I don't know if you want to describe the sequence that we have in the next couple pages.
Yeah, it's just an interaction first between Flint is a type A, take charge guy. Despite his inability or inexperience in certain areas, he's the one that's wanting to do it. But it's Darcy Vale that really stepped up as a leader and said, no, we got to send the person that knows how to work the electronic circuits on that drone. And then I thought it was interesting that they showed Yano as not being, so Darcy had to go from telling Flint no to telling Yano yes and encouraging her that she does have the experience. She's the most qualified. So a nice little piece is that Hammersmith gives Yano a rabbit's foot,
Yeah,
which is
well, that
also
was funny.
something. Yeah, I mean, that's so 70s too, right? I mean,
Yeah.
might as well get a pet rock while you're at it, And
Yeah.
Yano, she steps up and she heads out. Recent bias makes me think a drone. When I'm reading this, I'm thinking of a little, maybe a foot or two across. But in the story, this drone is like a ship, just a self-piloted ship.
Right. And then she's oh, gets over to the ship. She's reprogramming it. And then we do get an ad on the facing page to 29, reaching new heights of intergalactic excitement. Star Hunters, it's a special double length Origin and DC Superstars 16 on sale June 30th, and the Fantastic First issue on sale July 26th. So we get an ad for the first issue with yet another logo that was sort of hand drawn.
Oh, it is a different one. Yeah. This ad, this house ad, I remember very well.
It's sort of monochrome, like it's black in space with a monochrome sort of reddish figure of Donovan, the ship, and like some alien stuff. So it's kind of neat. So then Darcy is able, I'm sorry, not Darcy, Mindy is able to secure the drone. She has to really be brave and she's able to do it and is able to stop the drone. But then they say, uh-oh, the drone is going to blow up. You got to get back over here. You're going to be destroyed.
Yeah, she didn't just succeed. She had to get back, and they had to be evading this drone's attacks before she got back in. It was tense. It was tense. You could see the perspiration on her brow as she's flying back. Yeah, it's really good.
Yeah. So then we get on page 33 a giant whack-a-thoom as the drone blows up, but they're far enough away. Donovan has to say, "Well, bless me soul." I don't know what kind of accent that was, but we have to work on our Irish accents.
Bless me soul.
We close with some determination on Donovan's part. He's putting on a new shirt and she says, "Well, I guess that we've passed the point of no return," says Darcy. And the doctor's like, "I wonder what we'll find out there." At first, I thought he had a cigarette, but it's actually a pen in his hand.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not so sure that smoking is a good idea on a spaceship anyway. So, yeah, it's just the way he was holding it is interesting.
And he says, "By all the strength in these two hands, survive we will." So says Donovan Flint.
So says.
So says Donovan Flint. He's a true hero. He talks about himself in the third person.
Yeah.
What awaits our cosmic exiles on Junk World, the Sornaya artifact, death, or both? Find out in the first issue of Star Hunters on sale in July. I thought this was a great story. Again, I don't know why I wouldn't have bought the first issue, but I know I didn't. Dialogue is fun. Characters are good. We get basically the main character, Donovan and Darcy. We get a highlight for Mindy. We get introduced to the other characters. Presumably they'd get a little bit more of a highlight as the series goes on. You could explore them a little bit more. So I thought it was great.
Yeah, all in all, it was excellent. I think Darcy Vale is a badass. Can I say that? She's great. It's a lot of action from the beginning, and it really ends on a super tense action moment. Of course, the big explosion of the drone with the whack-a-thoom, you know, that's it's there, you know, no sound in space, but the readers, we need to see that, right? Because we need to hear it in our head. I love that Flint's full of himself. I love that Darcy's strong. I think it's well-rounded and so much opportunity. I can't remember of the future issues that I read of these seven here that I have. I only remember something quite in particular in issue 7, but I'll get to that maybe as we talk a little bit later.
I do want to hear your thoughts on the rest of the series in a little bit. But before we do that, I do want to talk some about David Michelinie. Give him a profile. We did a profile probably a couple years ago on Batman Family Reunion on Don Newton, but Michelinie is obviously a big part of comic history, so I will do a little profile of him. The sources I've got are, of course, Wikipedia as usual, but there's a great interview with him from a website called The Shift, and I'll include all the links in the show notes as usual. So he was born in 1948 and shares a birthday on May 6th with me and Brett Young, one of Brett Young's, another network all-star, one of his sons. He had a love of comics from an early age.
I started reading comics sometime in the early 1950s, so I have no idea what the first comic I read was. I know I read some classics illustrated and probably kids' comics like Casper the Friendly Ghost, Richie Rich, and the Karl Barks Duck books. By the time I was 8 or 9, I was reading more adventure stuff, mainly DC comics, but some from smaller publishers as well. I remember reading the first Justice League story in Brave and the Bold and the first revamped Flash story in Showcase.
Very cool. Michelinie grew up in Louisville, Kentucky, and worked at a commercial film production company before moving to New York to take part in an apprenticeship program started by DC Comics. Some of his earliest work was in The House of Secrets and Swamp Thing, the latter illustrated by Nestor Redondo. Michelinie and artist Ernie Chan created Claw the Unconquered in 1975. Donovan's hand in that one scene reminded me of Claw the Unconquered there a little bit. Another one of those short series that you might want to collect or if you don't have
yep.
them already. Well known, of course, to our network listeners, Michelinie did a run on Aquaman in Adventure Comics, which led to the revival of the Sea King's own title in 1977. And as we know, in Adventure Comics 452, Black Manta kills Aquaman's son, Arthur Curry Jr. The infant's death has affected Aquaman, of course, ever since. Michelinie also wrote the Karate Kid series, using the name Barry Jameson as a pseudonym. He also created Gravedigger in Men of War No. 1 from 1977. So the Star Hunters were created by Michelinie with editor Joe Orlando and artist Don Newton. They debuted in the issue we just read and continued on in their own short-lived series for 7 issues. We'll talk a little bit more about the story behind the story when I get to our special feature. But in the late 70s, Michelinie moved over to Marvel, where he did most of his most memorable work in comics. Among his best-known work are his 2 runs on Iron Man with co-plotter and inker Bob Layton, which introduced the characters alcoholism and specialized armor variants. He introduced 2 of Tony's closest comrades, Bethlehem Cabe and movie star Jim Rhodes, as well as new enemy Justin Hammer and epic battles with Dr. Doom. His most noted cliffhanger was when Stark is thrown out of the Shield's helicarrier and has to don his armor completely before he hits the ground. A scene that was sort of adapted in the first Avengers movie as we, you know, Tony jumps off the building, as we all know. He left Iron Man for the first time in 1981 and wrote several Star Wars issues, and those issues will actually soon be covered by Shag on From Empire to Jedi. His run went from 1981 to 83, and he co-created several Star Wars characters, including Plif, Shia Bree, and Fen Shisa. During this time, he also wrote a bunch of issues of the Further Adventures of Indiana Jones. Meanwhile, Michelinie was one of the writers on The Avengers from 1978 to 82 and worked with both John Byrne and George Perez. During this time, he and Byrne created another movie star, Scott Lang, in The Avengers number 181. And of course, he created the Taskmaster as well with Perez in 195. He reunited with Layton on Iron Man in 1986 and 215, and along with penciler M.D. Bright, closed out preceding writers Denny O'Neill's Advanced Idea Mechanics arc and launched the Armor Wars. And that's part of the omnibus that I recommended, during which this time he and Layton introduced another movie character, the Ghost. Michelinie said that he had thought he would never return to Iron Man, feeling by the end of his first run that he and Bob Layton had done everything they set out to do with the series. But when the editor offered him the assignment, he agreed to do it after about thinking about it overnight. He left Iron Man again after issue number 250 in 1989, closing his second collaboration with Layton with a sequel to their Iron Man Doctor Doom time travel adventure. Those are some great stories. In that interview on the Shift website, Michelinie offered some thoughts on the movie version of Tony Stark.
I love the first Iron Man movie, and I thought Robert Downey Jr. did a fabulous job. I also thought he was great in the sequels, though the stories weren't as good in my opinion.
So he also offered some thoughts on his most famous storyline.
Tony Stark's alcoholism is one of the first ideas I brought to the table after I was assigned to the Iron Man comic. When I suggested it, my co-plotter Bob Layton liked it, so we worked up a pitch and presented it to editor-in-chief Jim Shooter. Jim showed admirable professional courage by approving it, adding only one proviso, do it well, which I hope we did. There's no way the storyline would be published in the same way today. There are many reasons. Writers are different, artists are different, and editors are different. But most importantly, Marvel Comics, both commercially and creatively, is a different company now. The storyline might be tackled today, and it might even be better than the original, but it would definitely not be the same.
That's right. I mean, you know, it would, first of all, be like a 3-year storyline, and they've revisited it several times and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But he's absolutely right about that. But we're not even close to done with his career. From 1987 to 1994, Michelinie wrote Marvel's flagship The Amazing Spider-Man series, which featured the art of Todd McFarlane, Eric Larson, and Mark Bagley, while introducing more movie stars, the supervillains Venom in 298 and 300, and Carnage in number 361. Michelinie had originally planned to introduce Venom earlier and included a teaser scene in Web of Spider-Man number 18 in which Peter Parker is pushed by an off-screen Venom into the path of an oncoming train, the symbiote being unsusceptible to Spider-Man's spider sense that would normally have warned him of the attack. This was the first of what have been several clues leading to the reveal of Venom. Here's a quote from Michelinie on the creation of Venom.
When I was writing Web of Spider-Man, I started thinking about one of the title character's unique abilities, his spider sense. He had depended on that early warning tingle for decades, and it had often saved his life. So I wondered, what would Spider-Man do when faced with a vicious, unstoppable foe whose only goal in life was to kill Spider-Man, but who didn't trigger that essential spider sense? What would that do to his confidence, his self-image, his sense of security when he hid out in his Peter Parker identity? When the alien symbiote from Secret Wars became Spider-Man's costume for a while, it had been established that the symbiote didn't trigger Parker's spider sense. So I figured, what if the monstrous Spider-Man killer I was thinking of wore the symbiote? And that was the beginning of Venom. I had started to hint at the character in a couple of issues of Web, once when a hand came in from off-panel and pushed Peter in front of a subway train, and again when an arm came out of a window and yanked Spider-Man from a wall where he was clinging, and Peter was freaked out because the spider sense didn't warn him either time. Then, when editor Jim Salicrup switched me from Web to The Amazing Spider-Man, he told me he'd like to introduce a new character to make the upcoming issue 300 something special. I told him about the character I was hinting at in Web, and he liked it. But in my origin for that character, the symbiote joined with a woman who blamed Spider-Man for the deaths of her husband and child. Jim didn't think that readers would accept a female villain standing toe-to-toe with Spider-Man. Remember, this was decades ago. And asked if I could make the bad guy an actual guy. So I came up with a new origin for Eddie Brock, added a personality, a backstory, and a visual description. And that plot was sent to Todd McFarlane to draw. And thus, Venom was introduced to the world.
And regarding Venom's popularity,
it never occurred to me for a second that the character would rise to the height of popularity that it has. All I thought was that it would be a cool character that I would enjoy writing, and hopefully Marvel fans would enjoy reading. Anything after that was just icing on the cake.
In the early 1990s, Michelinie worked at Valiant Comics on the titles Hardcore, Turok Dinosaur Hunter, and Magnus Robot Fighter, and began working with DC again for the launch of the Justice League Task Force in 1993 with artist Sal Valuta. In 94, Michelinie became the writer of Action Comics, which he stayed on for 3 years. As one of the five principal Superman writers of the time, he co-wrote Superman the Wedding Album in 1996. David Michelinie and artist Paul Ryan are therefore the only comic book creators to have contributed to the wedding issues of both Spider-Man and Superman. That occurred to me, but I thought that was kind of fun. He also wrote a bunch of issues of Superman Adventures and Steel, as well as a bunch of miniseries, including Superman vs. Predator, which was his last credited work for DC Comics in 2000. After a hiatus, Michelinie returned to comics by teaming up with Bob Layton and Dick Giordano to form Future Comics, where he wrote Free Mind, Metallics, and Death Mask from 2002 to 2003. The company closed in 2004. I remember I had a few of those. They were pretty good, but they never really got off the ground.
Yeah.
I do remember those. Since 2007, he's written a variety of stories as a freelancer. For Moonstone Books, he wrote something called The Kolchak Tales, The Frankenstein's Agenda, as well as several prose short stories which appeared in a number of anthologies. Since then, he's returned to Iron Man and Venom several times for a miniseries for Marvel. As a screenwriter, Michelinie worked on two episodes of the animated series Iron Man Armored Adventures with Bob Layton as his co-writer, and wrote the short films Hellevator from 2011 and Nobody's Tomorrow from 2018, neither of which I had heard of, but maybe our film historian Rob Kelly has. Let's end on a couple quotes from Michelinie on his interaction with fans.
Conventions were in the early days when I started writing comics in 1973. Frequently, they were just one day long and often had no guests, just fans and merchants, and maybe a costume contest thrown in. But it was still exciting and amazing for someone who had dreamed of being a writer for most of his life. To see copies of comics I wrote for sale on dealer tables, just wow. I remember one incident after I'd been writing comics for a couple of years. I was at a New York convention as one of DC's writers. I was writing Swamp Thing then, and believe me, it was a scary challenge to follow Len Wein and Bernie Wrightson. And with a couple of issues published, I was to be on my first panel. When I got to the room, the previous panel was still going on. So I waited in the back of the room with several old pros, Denny O'Neill and such, who were to be on the next panel as well. As we waited, a kid maybe 15 years old started walking down the line, getting us to sign his autograph book. He got to me at the end, and I smiled as I signed my very first autograph. When I gave his book back to the kid, he seemed a little puzzled. Then he looked up at me and asked, "Who are you?" And then he said, "Oh yeah, you write Swamp Man," and walked away. I learned a humbling lesson that day. No matter how big you think you are, you aren't.
I love that story.
Yeah. He says, "The real reason I decided to write for a living was simple. I love to be told stories, either in comic books or movies, plays, everything. And I couldn't imagine a better way to spend my life by telling stories to other people. And fortunately, I've been able to make a living at it."
Yeah. Great ending. That's great. Yeah. So still with us at age 78. Mike's Amazing World shows that Michelinie has 601 credited stories and over 12,000 pages. Couple that with all his creations that have lived on in other media, a very, very impressive career. All right, so before we close, we do want to talk about the text feature. There is a two-page text feature in this issue called The Story Behind the Story, and I'll include both pages for anyone who wants to read them. And it's basically a story of how the Star Hunters came to be. It doesn't say, but it seems it's probably written by David Michelinie, but it doesn't write in the first person, but it's a lot of details about how the series was created.
I found on the Grand Comic Database that it was actually written by Paul Levitz.
Oh,
he was the editorial coordinator.
All right, well, makes sense. I didn't look that up, so good calls. We hear about how David Everest was calling it the survivors. The premise was the team of people who were secretly infected with a disease germ by the authorities. While the disease didn't affect them, it was deadly to anybody else they might be exposed to it. So they had to go through space, and they would colonize worlds, but then they would leave before other humans showed up, because otherwise they would infect them. So I thought that was kind of a neat thing. But then it went on, it didn't get accepted, because DC decided to do a true flying saucer science fiction series instead. Remember, at the time, science fiction was deemed to have to not sell well. We had all this glory days of sci-fi in the 50s. Then it sort of died out in comics. And this is now pre-Star Wars. This is the early 70s. So not seen to be commercially viable. So they were taking a chance. Now, UFOs were in the zeitgeist. And so they said, all right, well, let's do this true UFO stories comic book instead, which I thought was kind of funny. So those are my favorite parts. What stuck out to you in this story behind the story?
I've got just a lot of little bullet points here. Levitz points out that Space 1999 and Star Trek reruns, like they were doing well. And I like the description of the evolution of the story idea of this book. The first pitch going to Joe Orlando. Carmine liked the idea, but not the name. So The Outcast was the next choice before it could be launched. And like you said, it got switched over to UFO stories. McElhaney, although disappointed, moved on to Aquaman and Starfire. And then comes Jeanette Kahn in 1976 as the publisher, and she gave the go-ahead. McElhaney wanted Flint to be a different type of character, though, it turned out, which would have really affected, I think, the story. He wanted him to be more of a brooding character. But it was Joe Orlando that said, no, let's push the idea of that he's got this devil-may-care attitude.
Probably the right call.
Yes, I think so. Also, the right call is not calling the title World Tamer. I was like, what? And because the a regular 17 pages wasn't enough for a full origin to give all the characterizations that we need and concepts, it was given this 34-page spotlight in DC Superstars. Perfect.
Great stuff. You found another cool thing about the Star Hunters. You want to talk about discovering something in your collection?
Yeah, I've got some older comic. I know I didn't buy this off the shelf at a comic shop in Salt Lake City where when I lived out there, sometimes they just give me old fanzines because I bought so many comics. They're like, here, just take a few of these. And I think this is where I got it. Anyway, it's Comics Journal. Looked online to say, are there any fanzines that have articles about Star Hunters? And I brought up this Comics Journal number 40 from June of 1978. Turns out I had the issue. It's even though it's got the cover feature. You know, it features Star Hunters on the cover, a little bit different design because it's Mike Nasser doing the penciling, but it's still nice. It's just basically, I think the characters that are meant to be Flint, and here he's blonde, and Darcy Vale has red hair instead of black. It's just a short article, even though it got the cover spotlight. Frank Catalano wrote it, and he covers the entire story arc, or at least the first DC Special 16 and Star Hunters 1 through 5. And although he's complimentary of the writing, he gets a little critical of the dialogue. It's like real-time critique. It's almost like he's looking for something to make himself the sound discerning type of a critic.
That was kind of like what Comics Journal was famous for. They liked to be the squeaky voice in the stands.
That's true. Yeah. He pointed out some of the nonsense science, but again, in comics, it's never has been too much of a problem for me. Now, if a comic story talks about prisons and it's not accurate, then I'm all over it. So yeah, he just talks again about some of the things I said. Darcy Vale is stereotyped as the bitchy female boss, other than the well-done Errol Flynn persona of Flint being underdeveloped. I don't think they had a chance to fully develop anyone anyway. I think that's a mischaracterization by this writer of Darcy Vale. Maybe back then it was how it was portrayed or received, but nowadays it's like, yeah, she's a
She's tough.
strong
She's
woman
cool.
boss. Yeah. Yeah. And he mentions something that we didn't experience here together because you'd have to read the entire 7-issue series to see that Newton didn't stay on very long. It went from Newton to Hama to Nasser to Buckler, but the one consistency was Bob Layton's inks. So yeah, that was just some points that I seen in there.
Very cool. If you don't mind, you could send me a photo or a scan of the article. I'll include it in the show
Sure.
notes. You already
Absolutely.
sent me the picture of the cover of the Comics Journal, which is neat.
Yeah, I will do that. I just got my printer hooked up, so I can do that pretty easily.
Excellent. Fantastic. Well, gosh, that's about it. I ask everybody, Mike, did this comic live up to its special billing?
If there could be an extra complimentary adjective to special, maybe just extra special,
All
that's what
right.
it lives up to me.
That's awesome. Yeah, no, I thought it was great. Like I said, I might look for the other issues.
I'll help you look for them, I'll tell you that.
There you go.
I want you to read it. I want you to read that whole
Well,
series. Yeah.
hopefully you get out this way again. We'll grab lunch or something and go to a couple
Yeah.
shops together.
Perfect.
All right, so that's about it. Mike, do you have anything you want to talk about? Can you tell everybody about where they might be able to listen to you, contact you on social media, that kind of stuff?
For the last, gosh, has it been 9 years? I've been recording on a podcast called Campus Comics Cast. It's sort of your comic store centric podcast where it used to be a whole group of guys. Now it's just me and one other survivor, Scott Reed. And we just talk comics and we talk new and old. I also do the Mike's Comic Shop Roadshow, as you mentioned. The best way to get a hold of me is either by email. It's mike@comicshoproadshow.com. You can also find me on the Campus Comics Cast Facebook page. You can always drop a note in there if you like, if it's easier. It's always great to hear from people.
Well, thanks again for being on the show. I really appreciate it. Great to get a chance to meet you and talk, and good luck in your new house and all that kind of stuff.
Well, thank you. I'm so happy that I had the opportunity to record with you and that we had a great subject to talk about.
Well, I'm going to play a short promo. When I return, you'll hear this month's The Monthly Planet segment with Sean M. Myers, plus my next episode announcement and listener feedback. So stay tuned.
According to the latest report from falsifiedstats.com, there are currently 12 million active comic book podcasts clogging up the internet superhighway, and 2.3 million new comic book podcasts are being created every single day. That's a lot to choose from, and yeah, it can get a bit overwhelming, especially since most of them all sound the same. You know, it's usually one to five guys, and they're sitting around, and they're just talking about their top picks from all the new issues that hit the shelves that week. If you're looking for something a little different, then let me tell you about Mike's Comic Shop Roadshow. Mike travels the globe and visits comic shops along the way, talking to the owners, the managers, or really just whomever happens to be minding the store that day. And it's through these conversations that you'll meet some wonderful people and learn how comic shops are run in places like Murfreesboro, Illinois, Pearl City, Hawaii, and Liverpool, New South Wales, Australia. But even more, Mike takes a comic book recommendation from each shop. He reads the comic, and then he gets together with a special guest or guests to discuss the comic in question. So do yourself a favor and check out Mike's Comic Shop Roadshow, a truly unique comic book podcast among billions of the same old, same old. Find it now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Comic books in my hands, man. The smell of back issue pages, man. Comic shops, I've seen my share, man. I've been everywhere.
I'm Mike, and I approve this message.
Welcome back. I am Sean M. Myers, your co-editor-in-chief of The Monthly Planet. In this segment, Paul and I will discuss the beloved series of DC house ads, The Daily Planet, that ran in the back pages of DC Comics from 1976 to 1981. This month, we are discussing the issue from 50 years ago, August 1976.
And as always, we want to acknowledge our favorite website, Mike's Amazing World of Comics. If you click on Galleries, then Daily Planet, you can read all the issues there.
Plus, don't forget to follow our Blue Sky account, The Monthly Planet, for the issues and other fun. Okay, the first one up this month is the week of August 2nd, 1976. Dr. Savannah steals the Brooklyn Bridge. Mastermind also plots to kidnap Congress. New York, the world's wickedest man, Dr. Savannah, is on rampage, and it's going to be up to Captain Marvel to stop him. Target number one for the evil mastermind is the Brooklyn Bridge, that famous New York landmark that has been sold to unknowing tourists since the day it was built. And if you think that's bad, wait until you see what happens as Dr. Savannah plots to abduct the entire U.S. Congress. It's going to be a tough time for Captain Marvel for sure. Also, in The Case of the Kidnapped Congress by E. Nelson Bridwell and Kurt Schaffenberger, read about the new direction in Billy Batson's life as he and Uncle Dudley begin a tour of the entire country. It's all there in Shazam number 26.
All right. Now, did you read this one?
So I've read all of them.
All right.
And all of the ones that we're going to talk about, I did not have at the time of publication, the 50 years intervening. I did get all but two of them.
All right, very
so
good.
I have all but two of them.
I didn't have a complete set of the Shazam 70 series. I had a few of them, and I think I dropped off. I liked it a lot more when Don Newton came on and was in World's Finest and stuff like that. The original style wasn't as appealing to me. But I went and read. This one is on DC Universe, so I was able to read it this past week. Talk about crazy stuff. But I really thought it was interesting is so many times we've all had different comic series that we like or whatever where they get another media appearance and then they try to make it more accessible to people who come to reading the comic from watching the TV show. So in this case, Uncle Dudley is now going to be driving Billy around in a van, just like they did on the TV show.
Shazam van.
They even use the word mentor at some point during the story. I forget the context. And that's the name of the guy in the show. It wasn't Uncle Dudley on the show. Yep. His name was Mentor, you know, a little on the nose. I did enjoy that.
And they also bring in that red thing with the buttons to speak to the gods.
Speak to the gods. Yeah. So that was kind of fun. So I enjoyed it. How about you?
Yeah, so I did like it.
You're a bigger Shazam fan than me, so.
I'm a huge Captain Marvel fan, Shazam fan. Although, like, I have been thinking, when they brought him back in the 70s, that's right when comic books had the relevancy and that kind of, like, you had Green Arrow and Green Lantern and that kind of thing. But then they missed Captain Marvel so much that they kind of trapped him in that storytelling way.
Yeah,
and I do wonder, like, if the revival would have been more along the lines of
contemporaneous.
What that trajectory would have been.
I agree. I think it was because, I mean, as much as we love E. Nelson Bridwell and a lot of the other guys, and Denny Neal wrote it for a while too, but I think the marching orders were, hey, this guy was a great seller 20 years ago, do the same formula, and then they realized it didn't work, so then they started trying stuff. But I think by then, like, I lost interest. I know when he was in World's Finest, I wasn't buying it for Shazam. I was buying it for Superman and Batman and Green Arrow, Black Canary. You know, those were the characters I liked. And I read it, of course, and enjoyed it there. But he's never been one of my favorites because I was maybe at the wrong age for that. So I don't know. I was 11 years old here. Serious, grown up, you know, kind of, what do I want, this kiddie stuff kind of thing. You know, I don't know. I don't know. I agree with you. I think you're right.
But even me, like, I don't know if talking out of both sides of my mouth, because I do love the fact that you have Mr. Talkie Tawny. And like, would they have done that if it was contemporaneous and that kind of, and even like the villains, the Crocodile Man and stuff like that, would they have done that? So
it's hard to say.
And I do think that there should be comics for kids.
Absolutely.
You know, so
now it's different. Now you can read them and love them and enjoy them. It's a different feeling. But you know, when you're a kid and buying it on the month and which year you're going to spend your quarter on this week, that kind of thing, it's a different story. I think this is also the time where they were worried about comic book.
Yeah.
All newsstand sales of everything were declining. We're still a couple years away from the DC implosion, but it wasn't a rosy picture. I mean, it was a changing of the guard of old-timey creators and the new creators. So it's a tough time. And I think it was a good swing, but kind of a miss.
The other thing this makes me think of, I guess this probably would have been considered like a soft reboot, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because he was like caught in suspended animation, but so was Savannah.
Yes. That's how they brought him back in the first issue of Shazam. Yeah. But anytime I read that has a soft reboot, I always think of the Supergirl Digest, where they were able to fill 100 pages of soft reboot stories for Supergirl. Because like, she's at the orphanage. She is a soap opera actress. She works at New Athens.
Counselor, yeah.
Moving on to the next story. New Adventures of Korak. Man, I'm going to need help with this. Is this
Pellucidar?
Pellucidar.
That's how I've always said it. Yeah.
I'll probably need reminding every single time I read it. New Adventures of Korak and Pellucidar highlight Tarzan Family number 66, Africa et al. There's a new look to Tarzan Family beginning with 66. Leading off the issue is Korak, son of Tarzan, in a jungle tale about a gift most deadly by Tony Isabella, James Sherman, and Noli Zamora. And, not to be left out, David Inez travels anew in the world inside the Earth, Pellucidar, in The Amulet, The Power, and the Hero by Elliot Maggin and Jerry Taliaferro.
Yeah.
It's all in Tarzan Family number 66, coming your way the week of August 9th. Now, obviously, I have every issue of this and love it and treasure it always, because I couldn't even pronounce the name.
I had a couple issues of Tarzan Family. They're long gone. I did recently read a trade paperback of the Tarzan, the Joe Kubert years that I have had forever. And I did buy at a used bookstore one of those Pellucidar books. Basically, it's the story of the Hollow Earth, inside the Earth, and the explorations of that. It's nothing to do with Tarzan. It really should be Edgar Rice Burroughs' family.
Yeah.
But that's the extent of my knowledge. I haven't actually read that one yet. You got to be in the right mindset to read, you know, the original Edgar Rice Burroughs and so forth stories from 100 years ago, because they're a little rough. So I don't have a whole lot to say. It'd be one of those things, you know, on Mountain Comics, Rob would always say, you know, you go to the spinner rack and you've got everything, you don't want anything, but you got a quarter burning in your pocket, you buy something, then I might have bought Tarzan. Hey, if there's any Tarzan fans out there, yeah, and you love Tarzan stories, you know, chip in, let us know.
I'm sure there's going to be another blurb about Tarzan family. When you were talking about how the book should be called Edgar Rice Burroughs Family, family is kind of like the 70s version of verse, or like universe, like the Burroughs verse, the Burroughs family, the Batman universe. Let's Okay, our next story. Three foreign agents die in Gotham City. Three men keep a rendezvous with death on a street corner in Gotham City when a car careens out of control and kills them. Coincidence is what Commissioner Gordon calls it. But Batman disagrees, especially when he learns that the three were agents of a trio of foreign governments and that they had never met one another. It's murder, says the Caped Crusader, and he sets out to prove it. But the deaths of the three agents is just the beginning for Batman, as David V. Reed, Ernie Chua, and Tex Blaisdell demonstrate in Batman number 281, on sale the week of August 9th. Murder comes in black boxes, and so does doom for the Batman.
This was pretty good. I mean, David Reed was an old, he was David Verne, and was an old time writer. He wrote Batman number 300, the future version. He wrote that four-part one, The Many Deaths of the Batman.
Oh,
same guy. You know, he's a professional, and he knows what he's doing. Got to get around to doing him. Haven't had him on a profile on DC Specialcast yet, so I have to figure out a way to do that. But anyway, this one's, you know, it's typical. He's kind of mystery, and I'm not going to spoil it. He's usually a decent read.
I will say, if I've read this, I don't remember it. Like, the cover doesn't look familiar.
It's not one that, it's his best. The ones I remember are that many deaths, the Batman, the Batman the 300s, things like that. Those are things I remember. But yeah, fair enough.
All right, moving on to Direct Currents. On sale the week of August 9th, Black Hawk number 249, The Return of Killer Shark and War Wheel. I like War Wheel.
Mm-hmm.
Blitzkrieg number 6, another look at the battles of World War II as seen through the eyes of the enemy in this Joe Kubert, Bob Kaniger masterwork. House of Mystery number 247. A hunter after big game finds himself the hunted in The Game of Death by Jack Olek, Steve Ditko, and Wayne Howard. Then Arnold Drake and Jess Jody Oman present the story of a surfing duel and the ghost of Dead Man's Breach. That's Arnold Drake writing Dead Man.
Pretty funny, yeah.
Secret Society of Supervillains number 4. It's a super duper battle issue as the Secret Society squares off against Darkseid, who is determined to win his war for the Earth Death. Green Lantern is the special guest hero in this story by David Kraft, Pablo Marcos, and Vince Coletta.
Already writer number 2 on Secret Society of Supervillains, right? Jerry Conway, now David Kraft. Bob Rozakis will be there soon.
And then finally, Superman number 305, the Man of Steel versus one of his oldest foes, the original Toyman, a Pasco Swan Ochsner extravaganza.
That's a hard sentence to say three times fast.
I can never say Bob Ochsner, Ochsner, Ochsner. Oxner.
Doesn't roll off the tongue. I think we talked about Blitzkrieg before. That's the one where it follows the three privates in the German army. Interesting idea. Didn't really catch on. I think number 6 was the last issue, or number 5. It was number 5 or 6. They're hard to read.
Yeah, this is 6.
I think this is the last issue. Secret Society Supervillains was recently covered on Earth 2 podcast.
Okay, moving on to trivia quiz number 14.
All right. When I was reading and preparing, I skip over all the trivia
sections. So do I.
I don't even know what's coming.
Now, technically, I know over the last 50 years, I have read these trivia quizzes.
Yeah.
But
sometimes
secret identities aren't as secret as they should be. Do you know whose identities are known by Jimmy Olsen? What about Commissioner Gordon? Iris Allen? Carol Ferris? Pete and Jonathan Ross? Answers in next week's Planet.
We recently talked about Pete and Jonathan Ross.
Yes, so we should know those, but who knows? Okay, I kind of think both of us might have to work on this. We'll start with Jimmy Olsen.
I believe at this time, the Silver Age Jimmy knew Batman and Robin's secret identity.
Probably.
And I think that's it. So let me know if that's right.
Okay. Jimmy Olsen knows Batman and Robin's identities.
Excellent.
Commissioner Gordon.
Well, he knows Batgirl's identity, but that's it.
Correct, yes. Iris Allen.
Well, she knows Barry's identity. They're married a long time by now, so.
But not Kid Flash, right?
No, yeah, she knows Kid Flash.
He knows Kid Flash? Okay. Because it's not listed here, but wouldn't she?
She has to. She's his nephew. I mean, he's her nephew.
Wally's visiting Central City this weekend, and now Kid Flash
shows up. The kid with the red hair.
Carol Ferris.
It was not long before the Denny O'Neill Green Lanterns that Carol learned that Hal was Green Lantern. I want to say that was like 68 or 69. You know, I don't know exactly when Carol learned, but she learned before then. So, yes.
And then Pete and Jonathan Ross.
So They both know Clark is Superman, but neither one knows the other one knows. Did they have that right? That's what we decided before.
I think so. So in the answers in the next issue, it says, and the father-son team of Pete and Jonathan Ross know Superman is Clark Kent, but neither John nor Supes knows that Pete has that knowledge.
Right, because Superman knows that John knows. Okay. But, okay, I get that. Yeah, neither one knows that Pete knows. That was always a secret until the story later on where it comes out.
Yeah. DC Comics presents.
Yeah. Okay. We did pretty good on that.
Yeah. You did good. I wouldn't have.
Well, all right. Let's move on to the week of August 9th, 1976. The headline is The Teen Titans Tackle Dr. Light. Villain uses junior heroes to get at the JLA. Titans HQ, Dr. Light, the master villain who has tried time and time again to defeat the Justice League, has come up with a new scheme to get at the world's greatest superheroes. The Lord of Luminescence, look at that one, sends out a signal to Robin, Wonder Girl, Kid Flash, Speedy, and Mal to lure them into their Teen Titans headquarters and then traps them. With the junior heroes as hostages, Dr. Light hopes to gain entrance to the Justice League satellite and thereby trap the JLAers in their own home base. Can Dr. Light really become the man who toppled the Titans? Or will he be foiled? Paul Levitz, Pablo Marcos, and Bob Smith have the answers in Teen Titans number 44. Plus, on this issue, see what happens when Mal decides to become a full-fledged superhero. So what do you think of this issue?
I love this run of Teen Titans.
Yeah, this is a lot of fun.
Is it good? Not necessarily. And it is Don Heck art later on, right?
Yeah, right now it's Pablo Marcos, which is at least serviceable. Yeah.
And I think, is it Ernie Chua that does the last issue? Because I think the last issue is beautiful. It's like where it tells their origin.
The origin? I don't remember. We'll have to wait and see till we get there.
So one thing I want to say about the specific Daily Planet page is it does have the cover image, although that cover image is flipped from the issue.
Yeah, you're right.
And it has the old, I think both of them are kind of the old Teen Titans logo, mm-hmm. but like the actual physical issue kind of has just the regular font, and then the Daily Planet kind of has like their 60s logo.
Yeah, it's the one with the small eye in Titans.
Yeah.
This was where he scoffs at leaving Robin because he doesn't have superpowers. And of course, Robin figures out a way to free the other Titans and all that. So it's all good stuff. It's good stuff. I usually conflate this run of Teen Titans with Bob Rozakis, which he wrote, I think, most of them at the end. Forgot that Paul Levitz wrote probably the first couple issues.
Yeah, I like it. Kind of like we were saying. Like, it is interesting. Let's say this would have been a success. What would have happened with the new Teen Titans? Because then maybe that wouldn't have happened. And then what would Perez and Wolfman have worked on?
Perez wanted to work on Justice League, right? Remember, that's what the deal was. He said, I'll do Teen Titans, but I want to do Justice League, at least some issues. And you didn't want to take the work away from Dick Dillon. But then Dick Dillon passed away very soon after. So
this is not a murder podcast, by the way.
Yeah, no, not yet anyway. We're not mad at each other yet. But what if Perez had drawn a lot of those issues? It was still Jerry Conway. It's interesting to think about. I think he would have stayed on Justice League longer, but who knows? Who knows? Great question. All right, the next one, Losers Stalk the Chinese Warlord. And this one takes place in China during World War II. So it's a pretty big area. The Losers, who are Captain Storm, Johnny Cloud, and Gunner and Sarge, are off on a mission to China. Their target, the invincible Chinese warlord, General Yin, who is causing more trouble for the Chinese army than the invading Japanese. It's another Bob Kaniger, George Evans battle blockbuster coming your way in our Fighting Forces number 170. Don't miss A Bullet for the General. And also in this issue, Sarge goes on a solo mission, courtesy of Andy Fury and E.R. Cruz, which proves that Marines are born, not made. This is interesting. I don't have this issue, and it's not on DC Universe, so I haven't read it. But it's interesting in that, you know, Japan was invading China, and so they were ostensibly on our side, you know, on the Allies' side. But this Chinese warlord is causing more trouble than the Japanese. It's an interesting concept. Like, what's going on here? I kind of want to read the story and find out. You know, I wish I knew more. If anybody's read this story, any of our war comics fans out there, can let us know what really the details were around this story. I'd love to hear it. I don't know if you had any other thoughts.
Well, I've said this before. Like, there is no way in the world I would have purchased this 50 years ago. Absolutely not. Maybe even 20 years ago, I wouldn't have. Yeah. But now, I really will read any, whether it's romance or, you know, funny animals, obviously superheroes. I've read Sergeant Rock before in the Digest, when I got the Digest. Mm-hmm. But I have the DC Finest. So I'm going through that literally right now. I'm like halfway through. It really is like anything. Like, there are great stories. There are blah stories. There are obviously, like, you have the consistency of Kubert.
And right, the art's pretty, like, good in all these.
Come around to Kubert, yeah.
Yeah, it's hard because some of the war stories, especially in that first DC Finest, when I read that, the plot lines ended up getting very similar. It was hard to read a lot of them in a row, right? You gotta
and, put it down. Yeah, so that's kind of how I'm doing Sergeant Rock. Like, I'll read one or two stories and then go to another Finest and then read, I don't know, like 100 pages of that. And I do like that first war volume, and I'll get the next one and that kind of thing. But it is kind of like there's a soldier, and he's thinking about how at home he was like an expert skier and he misses skiing, but, well, there's no way I'm going to ski because it's summer right now. And then, like, something happens that he uses his skiing skills to get a hand grenade away from someone.
Yeah, keeps repeating that kind of stuff. But they sold a lot, you know.
Yeah.
Again, I think it's the difference between a casual reader and a fan, right? Like, if there was somebody who just wanted to read it and say, oh, that looks interesting to read, and they read that story, well, that was all pretty good, but they're not reading it every month, or they're not reading, they also didn't read 10 war books in a row. Yep. They would get 5 comics maybe, and one of them was a war comic. It's a good afternoon, right?
Yeah.
On to the Direct Currents, on sale the week of August 16th. All-Star Comics number 63, The Death of Dr. Fate, Don't Tell Shag, and that's only the beginning. At the Injustice Gang, Xanadu with a Z, the Chaos Maker, and a mysterious guest hero, and you've got the Super Squad story of the decade, courtesy of Paul Levitz, Keith Giffen, and Wally Wood. Great story. The Xanadu character is a hoot. Claw number 10, our hero wraps up his battles with everybody, an epilogue by David Michelinie, Keith Giffen, and Bob Layton. Not sure if this was the last issue, but it's probably getting close to the end if it's not the last issue of Claw. At one point, I had got all these in, like, the dollar bin and read them, and they're long gone again. I don't really remember much of the story of Claw, to be honest with you. I don't know. Have you ever read Claw?
No.
Yeah.
I can't even picture the gray hair. I know that's Stalker. I don't
know. No, Stalker's better. Stalker's pretty fun, actually. But Claw is the guy who had a curse. His hand was replaced with a demon claw. Superman Family 180. The Girl of Steel suffers amnesia blackouts, making it awfully hard for her to discover the secret of the spellbound Supergirl in this tale by Kerry Bates and Kurt Schaffenberger, plus the 9 lives of Jimmy Olsen and the girl that almost married Clark Kent. So this is before Dollar Comics, so that Supergirl story is the new one. The Unexpected and A Trio of Tales Have a Wonderful Crime, George Kasdan and E.R. Cruz. What Haunted Herbert by Al Casey and Jess Jodiaman, again, the same guy you talked about. And Escape the Treachery by Jack Phillips and Gary Talawak. Gary Talawak, by the way, he did the Phantom Fringer for a while. He's not a bad, very moody kind of artist. I kind of like him. And then Weird War Tales, 4 stories of the weirdest wars ever. The Face of the Enemy, Mark of the Conqueror, The Day After Doomsday by Steve Skates, Steve Ditko, and Vince Colletta. We talked about The Day After Doomsday, it was last month and the month before. And A Right to Die by George Kasdan and Ricardo Villamonte. And then Weird Western Tales, a lot of weird tales. But this is Jonah Hex. It's probably not long before it changes the name to Jonah Hex. He stars in Requiem for a Gunfighter by Michael Fleischer, Rich Buckler, and Frank Springer. That is probably, they just announced recently they're going to be another Western DC Finest coming out this fall. So that, I think, is when they'll catch up to this where we are here. So that'd be great.
Those stories are very good.
The Western Finest was awesome. That was great. I highly enjoyed that.
So obviously the bulk of it is Jonah Hex, but there's also El Diablo and
Son of Tomahawk.
Yes. And then, oh, I'm so ashamed. The father, I think, is a sheriff, and his son kind of turns to crime.
Outlaw.
Outlaw. That, yeah.
I think all the Outlaw stories were in the first Finest.
But we find out
that the son is really good by the end. Yeah. So that was all good. Those were all terrific stories.
I like that. Yeah. And again, 50 years ago, I would not read a Western comic, but now I'm glad that I have expanded my horizons.
All right, Sean, you ready for the trivia?
Yeah.
All right. Trivia quiz number 15. Batman's been teaming up with lots of the DC superstars in The Brave and the Bold. Can you name the one crime fighter who's worked with him most often in that magazine? And do you know which prominent DC hero has never joined the Caped Crusader in Brave and the Bold? Who has been the most frequent? Now, this is 1976. Yeah. If you give me a few, then I'll tell you what you think.
So, luckily, I've been reading the team-ups. So, I'm going to guess one, and I'm going to say Wildcat. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
The answer that Bob gives us is the crime fighter who's worked with Batman most often is Commissioner Gordon. I'm like, wow, that's a cop-out, Bob.
And especially because it's like the brave and the bold. So, you're thinking like what name is on the cover, like the logo. And
we love Bob. But he gets a big red mark for that one in me. But yeah, yeah. Wildcat and Green Arrow, you know, Sergeant Rock. It's in the Team-Up Companion by Tomorrow.
Oh, yeah.
And it's been a little while since I read that.
So I was thinking about this. Who has Batman never teamed up with in the Brave One? And probably even Superman, although I hate that. And again, I don't know what the answer, but it probably would be Shazam, Captain Marvel. Aren't I right in thinking that he was never, ever in The Brave and the Bold, but he was in DC Comics Presents. That story is fantastic. But are there other... Is that what the answer is?
The answer is Superman, because... Oh. Have we gotten to 150 yet?
No, because it's 131. 131 is coming up soon.
I had to read it. Definitely Superman, but there probably were plenty of others at this point.
Claw, Stalker.
Exactly, Claw and Stalker. Justice Society heroes. You know, there's lots of ones. Yeah, when you ask a negative question like that, but the one they were going for was Superman. I think he was trying to be like a trick question, because you think, oh, Batman and Superman, they're best pals. They're in World's Finest every month. And, you know, he's trying to catch you with trick questions on both ends. All right, let's move on to the next one.
Okay, the week of August 16th, 1976. Wonder Woman dies.
We've
never ever heard anything about her ever since. Freedom fighters held responsible for her death. New York. Wonder Woman is dead as a result of her battle with King Samson, and District Attorney David Pearson is holding the freedom fighters responsible. The Amazon was an important part of crime fighting here in New York, Pearson told reporters in an interview. And if not for the incompetence of the freedom fighters, she would still be alive today. What Pearson failed to mention was that he ordered 3 of the 6 FFers to jail, while the other half of the team joined Wonder Woman in an attempt to stop the rampaging King Samson, thus weakening the team and creating the situation which resulted in the death. But can a superheroine ever really die? Uncle Sam doesn't think so, and he and his fellow FFers that's weird to say, are doing their darndest to prove it in The Rise and Fall of King Samson, a Barbara Zakas, Ramona Fraiden, Vince Coletta extravaganza in Freedom Fighters number 5, on sale the week of August 23rd.
Also was covered by our pals over at Earth 2.
So I am collecting all of the Freedom Fighters. So I did read this issue. And I think I am using this right, especially like in movies or TV show. When the story starts off in the middle of the story, that's called in media res, correct?
Correct.
Yes. So this story starts off and I'm thinking it's in media res because the stuff is happening. And I'm like, oh, well, did this happen last issue or this is happening? And then they're going to go back and explain what happens. So I'm reading it and I'm like, oh, okay. So this happened and now they're going to explain what happened and then they'll catch you up to the story. So I'm reading this and they are talking about what happened the issue before. But you know how when it's a recap, you know it's a recap, and at the most it's like a page? Oh my God, this feels like it's 6 pages long. That's what made me... It's not 6 pages long, but it felt like... That's what made me think, oh, they're going back and tell... No, they went back and told me what happened in the issue previous, which I didn't read. So I'm like, wow. I mean, I like the Freedom Fighters, and I will say, Wonder Woman dies, so it's not like a fake out. She does die. You figure out why
she's been turned back.
But she does, yeah. She coughs it off and rubs dirt in it and gets back up.
Freedom Fighters are great. You know, it suffered from some of the same changes in creative teams. But yeah, Ramona Fraiden on there, just solid art. Although, I think this cover where Uncle Sam is holding Wonder Woman, I want to say that's Rich Buckler.
Buckler and Coletta. It's easier to see on the cover.
Yeah, it looks like Rich Buckler. That's kind of what I thought. But it's hard on these little, you know, I'm looking at the printouts you gave me. It's hard. I don't have a ton to say. Those guys over, like I said, at Earth 2, they did a good job covering the Freedom Fighters, and they're still doing it. They're rollicking Bob Zakas Bronze Age comic. Someday maybe we'll get around to the Freedom Fighters.
Batwoman's in it.
Batwoman is in it.
Okay, the next story. Aquaman uncovers the secret of Karshan, Atlantis. The dethroned ruler of Atlantis, Aquaman, has finally uncovered the secret of the man who took his place as ruler of the undersea kingdom. In Crown, Crisis, and Cataclysm, You'll learn everything you've ever wanted to know about Karshan, as the entire Aquaman family of characters are on hand for a full-length story by Paul Levitz and Jim Aparo. You may have some ideas about the secrets of this new Sea King, but we'll bet you're going to be very surprised after reading Adventure Comics number 448 on sale the week of August 23rd.
And this one's got Jim Aparo. All right. I didn't actually reread this one. Did you reread this one? I can't remember what happened.
No.
Well, we're not far away from the end of Aquaman's run and adventure where he gets his own comic back. That's coming up pretty soon, I think.
Okay. Bob, I have a bone to pick with you, because this next story should have been the A number one cover story and blurb, and there should be a picture. Bob Rozakis, I know that technically we love you, but the week of August 16th, 1976, I did not like you. This should have been the headline and the picture. Super Friends battle Super Foes, Hall of Justice. It looks like a battle royal for the Super Friends as the Justice Leaguers and their junior partners, Wendy, Marvin, and Wonder Dog, are attacked by a group of supervillains who have baddies in training working with them. So enter the Penguin, Toy Man, Cheetah, Poison Ivy, and here it says Flying Fish, but it's the human flying fish, and their sidekicks. And the new Super Friends find themselves facing the fury of the Super Foes in Super Friends number one on sale the week of August 23rd. Direct from your television screen comes these all-new adventures of your favorite heroes, chronicled by E. Nelson Bridwell and Rick Estrada. It's a magazine you and your friends won't want to miss. So get to your comics dealer early so you don't miss it.
Ba-ba-ba, so Super Friends number one.
How is that not? It's a number one issue. So I'm kind of, whatever, retroactively giving grace. Maybe like the cover artwork wasn't done, or the front page. Maybe
that's certainly possible.
Come on.
Although Wonder Woman dies is a pretty good headline.
How many issues of Freedom Fighters were there? 9? 11? Something like that. Super Friends ran 47 issues. So come on.
Sorry, Bob. When he gets like this, I can't control him.
I'm not doing the show anymore. I'm so mad. I cannot continue to exalt something that Bob Rozakis worked on when he betrayed me like this 50 years ago.
Although, why don't you read the next entry?
Yes, he's going to make up for it, because in the direct currents on sale the week of August 23rd is Batman Family number 8. It's full-length solo action for Robin as he sets out to solve the disappearance of Bruce Wayne and ends up in the middle of The Copycat Girl Capers by Bob Rozakis, Irv Novik, and Vince Coletta. Plus, Batgirl's Last Case and The Web of the Spinner.
Forgot about that Web of the Spinner story. That was a pretty funny one.
Yeah, that was a good one. And I know I told this story on Batman Family Reunion number 8, but the first copy of that I had, I bought like at a farmer's market and it didn't have a cover. Then years later, when I bought like the pack of Batman Family altogether, that's when I got the one with the cover. Yep. DC Superstars number 9, The Man Behind the Gun. A collection of tales about weapons of all times and shapes. Superman comes up against the Sightless Sharpshooter, the U.S. sails the Unsinkable Gun, and spacemen of the future learn the secret story of Raygun 64.
Yeah. So this is definitely eligible for the show, but I haven't had anybody volunteer for this one yet. So if somebody wants to read The Man Behind the Gun, DC Superstars number 9, just send me an email.
Okay, the next one is G.I. Combat number 196. The Men of the Haunted Tank go on a Dead Men Patrol by Bob Kaniger and Sam Glanzman. While Burt Reagan and Fred Carrillo present the men of the OSS in Operation Slaughterhouse. Moving on to Superboy number 221. The Time Trapper is back and his target is the $1 billion trophies in this titanic tale by Jim Shooter and Mike Grell. Now, this is just billed as Superboy 221, but it's Legion, right?
Yep. Yeah, it hasn't officially become Superboy in the Legion yet, but it's pretty close to.
Tarzan number 255. Continuing our adaptation of the Edgar Rice Burroughs Tarzan the Untamed. Denny O'Neill, J.L. Garcia Lopez.
Praise be his name.
And Frank Springer present Death in the Sky. Okay, trivia quiz number 16.
All right, I'm ready. What's this one about? Let's see.
Some of our DC titles have been around since the dawn of comics, but do you know which one is the oldest? In what order, and we'll repeat these slowly, in what order did Action Comics, Adventure Comics, All-Star Comics, Detective Comics, Flash Comics, and Star Spangled Comics make their newsstand debuts. I kind of think let me go first because I won't know them as well as you do. So the first one is Action. That's easy.
That's not right.
Oh, all right. I flamed out already.
Well, first of all, we know Detective was around before Action. Because remember, Batman was in Detective 27, and that was only a year after Superman.
Oh, I didn't know it was a year. I thought it was whatever, 27 issues after. Oh, okay.
Detective is before Action, and I'm pretty sure Adventure Comics, it was called New Adventure Comics. First, there was New Funnies, was like one of the very first ones. And then I think New Adventure Comics was billed as all new. I think it was New Adventure Comics, Detective Comics, Action Comics, Flash Comics, All-Star Comics, and Star Spangled Comics, I think, was the last.
More is more fun.
Is more fun in there?
No. I'm just adding that in on my own.
Near the beginning. I don't know if it was before or after, but I think it was early. I think the answer is, and I'm covering up the other page. I think the answer is New Adventure, Detective, Action, Flash, and then Star Spangled. So let's see what it says. Adventure Comics.
Wait. So hold on. Don't look because. Okay. So you are right, but you forgot one. But that's fine because there was a ton of. You were right with Adventure.
Yep.
Detective.
Yep.
Action. Yep. Flash. But now there's two more. It's All-Star and Star Spangled.
I'm going to say All-Star before, but I'm not positive about that.
Correct. You got them right. Yes. Good job.
Excellent. Wow. Yeah, that was a hard one.
No wonder you're the brains of this operation. I'm the thighs of this operation. You're the brains.
You're the good looks. All right. All right. The week of August 23rd was our next issue of the Daily Planet. Luthor turns Superman into Superboy? What? Batman and the Flash suffer a similar fate. In Metropolis, Lex Luthor, the criminal mastermind who will try anything to beat Superman, has come up with a new way to defeat the Man of Steel by turning him into the Boy of Steel. Testing out his scheme by rejuvenating the Flash and Batman, Superman's arch foe now turns it on his prime target. And it goes into effect when Clark Kent is attending a party thrown by Galaxy Communications boss Morgan Edge. How can Clark cover his suddenly youthful appearance? And more importantly, how can an impulsive Superboy defeat the mature Luthor? Kerry Bates, Kurt Swan, and Tex Blaisdell will have the answers in Think Young and Die, the cover feature of Action Comics number 465 on sale the week of August 30th. Plus, in the backup spot, look behind the scenes at the sporting life of Steve Lombard in The Paper Hero, Marty Pascoe, Kurt Swan, Frank McLaughlin. This is great stuff. Yeah, you got your issue right there. The cover's great where you got Superman hitting Lex, but then in an inset, Lex hitting Superboy. And they really played it pretty well. This was prime Kerry Bates, Julie Schwartz stuff here. I assume you really like this one too.
I do really like this a lot. The second part, that cover is probably even more well-known. Luthor's punching, it looked like a six-year-old.
Yeah, he looks really young then. Yeah.
Yeah, I know. I like that in the story, Clark Kent is at a party and he starts to like de-age and everyone at the planet sees Clark Kent de-age. And you are kind of thinking, well, how's he going to get out of this? So I do like that. Yeah.
And even I don't want to spoil that one because this one I would think our listeners would really like reading it because this is a great one.
Yeah, this is a great one. And then also even like the sporting life of Steve Lombard, which like I don't care about Steve Lombard, but like the story is really good. When I say really good, I don't mean like I don't know that it should have ended up in the digest of Year's Best Comic Stories, but it's really enjoyable. I do like it a lot.
Yeah. Next, the superheroes face a crisis in tomorrow. On Earth 1, Kull, the king of the Beastmen, has launched his third attack. And this time, the target is Earth 1 and its city of the future tomorrow. Using Mr. Atom and Brainiac as his pawns, Kull presents a battle most deadly to the Flashes and the Green Lanterns of Earth 1 and 2, Ibis the Invincible, and Mercury, the Messenger of the Gods. But if you think that's going to be a battle, wait till you see the grand finale of this issue when Captain Marvel squares off against a deranged Superman. It's action all the way as only E. Nelson Bridwell, Marty Pascoe, Dick Dillon, and Frank McLaughlin can present in the Justice League of America number 137. All right, so this is the third part of three. We talked about the other two parts previously. This was the famous cover where you got Superman flying up towards Captain Marvel, where Kull, the bad guy, is standing on the Rock of Eternity. So that's, I think everybody knows that cover. What do you think of this storyline, the three issues all together, and then maybe this particular issue? I think everybody's read this.
So I will say, because I was talking about how Super Friends should have been the cover spot. Theoretically, maybe you could argue that Justice League should have been the cover. But as you were talking, I was listening, but as you were talking, I looked back. And the Justice League issue that was last month that had the second part, for that Daily Planet, that definitely was the biggest one. So I understand why you wouldn't necessarily want to have like two of the same. So I'm fine with that. Love the cover. Love everything about it. This is the one where it's the fake supergroup that they never really were.
I thought Ibis the Invincible was a much bigger deal than he was.
Yeah. And I do like Ibis. I'm the one, if you have a god-awful costume in your mind that you hate, I probably legitimately love it. But Bullet Man and Bullet Girl are absolutely ridiculous with their conehead bullet heads. Like, I just think that's ridiculous. And you have Mr. Scarlet and Pinky, and that's kind of that fake group. I'm not super.
It doesn't really instill fear into the hearts of criminals.
But you do legitimately have Captain Marvel and Superman in a story together. Yep. So I do like that. And obviously, I like all of the JLA, JSA team-ups. And
some are better than other. I would argue not one of the best ones.
I would agree. Yeah.
When I was reading this the other day, I did appreciate that if you look carefully, you've got Dick Dillon, right? And he's the Justice League guy. When I think of the Justice League in Bronze Age, you think of how Dick Dillon drew him, right?
Yes.
But he makes an effort to draw Captain Marvel very much in the C.C. Beck style, his eyebrows and eyes and that sort of stuff. So I thought that was pretty neat. I don't recall noticing that before. I'm sure I've noticed it before, but I noticed it the other day. So I thought I'd mention that. He did a great job on that. All right, let's move on. The Ploppers visit the D.C. offices. Cain, Abel, and Eve, the madcap hosts of Plop, will be paying a visit to the D.C. offices to see just how their magazine is published in Plop number 24, on sale the week of August 30th. While there, the Ploppers will witness the origin of comic book McFiend by Don Edwin and Dave Manek, A Fate Worse Than Death by Sergio Aragonés, meet Guido the Artist by Steve Skates, Carrie Bates, and Rick Estrada, and get to check out all the regular features, including Ploppular Poetry and the Ploppular Person of the Month. I want to read this one.
I agree.
I've never read this one. I want to read it.
I hope DC Finest does humor-ish. However I can get Inferior 5, I want to get Inferior 5. I like a couple of their issues. I want to get that. I think there were two Plop Digests. Now, I know in the first Best of DC Digest, it's Superman, but then there are pages that have Superman humor thing, and that's from Plop, which at the time I didn't know that. Is there a Plop cast?
All right, let's move on to Direct Currents, the week of August 30th. Detective Comics 465, a gang of crooks kidnaps Commissioner Gordon in an attempt to learn the best-kept secret of Gotham City. What is it? Well, Batman's secret identity, of course. But don't think the Masked Manhunter is going to be found out quite so easily in another story by David Reed, Ernie Chua, and Frank Chiacoa. Plus, the Calculator sets loose the elongated plague at a comic book convention. And it's up to the elongated man to stop it, of course, by Bob Rozakis, Chua, and Terry Austin. So this is one of the middle chapters of the Calculator saga we've covered a few months ago. The Batman story, I think we talked briefly about it at the time. So good stuff.
It's where they leaned into Commissioner Gordon being Barney Miller. Hal Linden, handsome, sexy.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Commandy 48, the cure for Commandy's attacks of violence is found, but it's in Pyra's spacecraft, miles out of reach for the last boy on Earth, as he battles Sacker's minions in this Denny O'Neill, Dick Ayres, Ernie Chua. The many words in that sentence, I don't really know or care much about. We talked about Commandy before. I've not read the post-Kirby stuff, so I don't really have much to say.
I kind of hope they don't reprint them in DC Finest, because I'll be forced to reel.
They have done recent reprints of all the Kirby stuff, the first 40 issues. The ones after that, I'm not sure have ever been reprinted. Maybe it's somewhere. Our Army at War 299. Again, Kaniger, Kubert, and Redondo present a new battle blockbuster, Sergeant Rock, and the Combat Happy Joes of Easy Company. So they don't even give us the titles of the story there, so they must not know much about it at the time of this.
Well, I will say, reading the war book, I never, ever have to read Combat Happy Joes of Easy Company ever again. But I know I'm gonna hear. I know I'm gonna read it 12,000 more times.
And then there's Young Love 122, heart-throbbing tales for the young and in love. There's No Such Thing as Love by Jerry Conway and Rick Estrada. 20 Miles to Heartbreak by Barbara Freelander, Alex Toth, and Vince Coletta, and loads of special features. All right, trivia quiz number 17. Since Superman has changed into Superboy in this month's action, let's return to the days when he really was the Boy of Steel and ask you to name, one, his hometown, his foster parents, the girl who lived next door, and the chief of police. All right, Sean, these are easy ones. Hometown.
Oh, man. No, so it's easy except the last one. So his hometown is Smallville.
Yep.
His foster parents are Ma and Pa.
What are their names?
Ma and Pa Kent, Jonathan, and Martha.
Martha! On Earth 2, though, what their names were.
Oh, is it still Jonathan?
Eben and Sarah.
Oh, okay. I think I knew that. Well, yeah. I didn't know it, but if it was a multiple choice, I would have been able to circle the right one.
Yep.
The girl who lived next door is Lana Lang.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, chief of police. Henderson? Or is that much later?
I think that's later. Let me see what the answer is.
Way later. And so it doesn't count, but give me the first letter of the last name. P?
P.
Potter? I don't know.
Parker. Chief Parker.
Oh, I don't
yeah,
know. I've gotten at it with a multiple choice.
I've certainly read stories with Chief Parker in it, but I didn't remember before I looked.
Now, did he have the lamp that lit up? I guess probably.
I don't remember that.
So like when he needed to be contacted, the lamp in the Kent living room.
Oh, I remember that now. Maybe he had like a switch.
Okay, moving to the last week of August.
Hey, we get five?
Yeah.
Because we love you. We're bringing you more Daily Planet, listeners.
The summer ends, and I know technically the summer doesn't end, but for me, the summer is June, July, August. So the last week of summer for me, week of August 30th, 1976, is Superman destroying Metropolis. Hero battles Bizarro for answer. Metropolis. There's been destruction in Metropolis like no one's seen before, and it could only have been caused by someone with superpowers. Little wonder, then, that the prime suspect is the city's number one superhero, Superman. But is it the Man of Steel on a rampage, or is it his weird duplicate, Bizarro? With that question in mind, who will have to stop whom when the power pair square off in the backward battle for the Bizarro world? Bizarro is more determined to get Superman than ever before. This one's a Martin Pasco, Kurt Swan, Bob Oxner blockbuster that no superfan will want to miss. In Superman number 306, on sale the week of September 6th.
It's not as good as the other Superman story.
It's not as good as the other Superman story. And Bizarro...
Bizarro acts a little weird in this. His speech, he sounds like the Hulk when he's talking, as opposed to Bizarro. Don't you think? I actually read this one last night. I didn't think Marty Pasco had a handle on how Bizarro is supposed to talk.
So I'm kind of like iffy on Bizarro, because I used to think, oh, I love Bizarro. And then I guess probably back in the 90s, there was some collection of Bizarro stories, Bizarro World. And then I read them like, oh my God, these just make my head hurt. I think because he's Superman's imperfect duplicate.
Mm-hmm.
But I think they kind of lean on like opposite too mm-hmm. much, like mm-hmm. me am hate you means mm-hmm. I love you, but then they don't carry it all the way, because then not like Zatanna like, but why isn't he speaking backwards? Why isn't,
yeah,
if he's the opposite, why isn't he a woman?
Yeah, he doesn't have a strong through line or theme. He's not backwards though, he's Bizarro, right?
And right, so yeah
I personally think he's best suited to be more lighthearted or humor. I like it better when he's getting into just mischief. He likes Superman, wants to help him, but he does things wrong, you know, that kind of stuff. It does get old, like all those stories where the square world, and then this one, he's trying to create more duplicates of Lois and himself. Yeah. He thinks he's destroyed the thing. Superman has to straighten him out. I would venture to say it's not the best Bizarro story either.
Now, me having said all that, hey, Hollywood, guess what? Superman has more villains than Lex Luthor. I would love to see Bizarro in a movie.
Yeah. They went with the more John Byrne, you know, when they did the clone Ultraman, they called him Ultraman, and he wasn't deformed like Bizarro. I kind of think if he comes back, he'll be deformed like
Bizarro. Oh, so do I. Yeah, so do I. Yeah.
So we might have gotten him, but I hear you.
Okay. Abel and House invite readers to Fear Fest. The House of Secrets and its bumbling host, Abel, invite all DC readers to a Fear Fest being held in their magazine this month. Witchblood by Jack Olek, Ernie Chua, and Bill Drault heads the bill, followed by The Evil Side by Steve Skates and Ruben Yandock, and The Experiment by Skeets and Vincente Alcazar. Add a page of Abel's Fables by Don Edwig and Dave Manick, and you've got a real treat in the House of Secrets, number 143.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with any of those stories.
Not that I know of, but I have a respect now for the horror stories. I like reading them. Okay, Isis battles creature from Dimension X. Also faces panic at political rally. Isis, TV superstar and DC's newest heroine, really has her hands full in the second issue of her magazine. First, Steve Skeets, Mike Vosburgh, and Vince Coletta have her face-to-face with the creature from Dimension X. This one's a battle like you've never seen on ISIS's Saturday morning television program. But if that's not enough, Skeets then joins forces with Mike Nasser and Frank Giacola to unleash a political rally panic to keep our girl busy. If you're a fan of ISIS on TV, or even if you've never seen her before, you'll really enjoy ISIS number 2, on sale the week of September 6th.
Yeah, they're pushing ISIS. Again, I did not buy this. I don't have a lot of feeling one way or another about ISIS. The artwork's probably pretty good. You got Mike Nasser, you got Mike Vosburgh. You know, I'm sure there was very attractive ladies in it.
I have one or two issues. You know, if I found them cheap enough, I would get it. I like ISIS. Like, I know it's simple. I think her costume is fantastic.
Yeah, good costume. You can tell what she's from, that sort of Egyptian thing. Yeah.
Okay, moving over to the direct current. On sale the week of September 6th. Batman number 282. Three men are dead, but were they murdered by the same man? Batman is on the trail and finds himself facing four doorways to danger. A David V. Reed, Ernie Chua, Tex Blaisdell thriller.
I didn't reread this and I don't recall it. I'm sorry.
That's okay. This next one is DC Special number 25, The Three Musketeers, star in Die by the Sword by Bob Haney, Jack Sparling, and John Kalman, plus Robin Hood in The Forest of Traps, The Bow That Couldn't Be Bent, and another Viking Prince Adventure.
Yep, this was the last one starring the Three Musketeers. David Steele and I covered this a few months ago. Good stuff.
Starfire number 3. The Mygorgs are after Starfire and her band, and they're using a human named Moonwatcher to track them right into the Arena of the Frost Dragon. In this story by Elliot Magan, Mike Vosburgh, and Vince Coletta. And then moving on to Star Spangled War Stories, number 203. The Unknown Soldier battles behind the scenes of World War II in Curtain Call by David Michelini and Jerry Taliok, plus Ants, a backup war tale by Doug Mensch and Bill Drott.
I don't know what Ants is. That's an intriguing title.
That is interesting.
All right.
Trivia quiz number 18. As we write this, the planet's ace production person, Anthony Tolan, is preparing for his wedding. So, let's ask you about superheroes and their wives. Can you name the four members of the Justice League who are married and also give the names of their wives?
All right. At 1976, you clearly have Barry Allen the Flash married to Iris. You have Carter Hall, a Hawkman, married to Shira Hall. You have... who else am I? I guess Ray Palmer is married at this point. Is he not married? Oh, he's not married yet. That's right. That's right. He's not married yet because that story hasn't been written yet. Don't marry her, Ray. She's not worth it. Who else was Justice Leader at this time? Aquaman is married to Mera. And then, and the Elongated Man, of course. Married to Sue.
Yes.
There we go.
Good job.
Oh, I knew all those. I just had to go through my whole list of characters.
What a way to end the summer.
All right. But we're not quite done. We do have our assessment of August 1976 for you. So we have a couple awards. So first one is the photo award. All right, Sean, which of these little pieces of art do you like the best?
I have them all printed out. Let me flip. I have an idea. It's not just the cover. It's not just the headline. It's also all of them.
So yeah, any of the pieces of art. There's usually two little pieces of art in each issue. We got three of this last one. I'll tell you mine.
Go ahead.
Mine was the Freedom Fighters cover of Uncle Sam carrying Wonder Woman by Rich Buckler, as you mentioned. Close second is the cover of the Justice League of Superman coming up against Shazam.
I have to go with Superman and Captain Marvel because I love Captain Marvel. My strong second place, although I don't think it's reproduced very well, would be the Titans cover.
Oh, it's reproduced very poorly. Yeah.
It's very, very squished.
Yeah, when they have to get a whole bunch of characters, especially with detailed artists like Ernie Chua or Rich Buckler, it's a struggle. The Kurt Schattenberger Dr. Savannah, that looks good in the reproduction size of the Daily Planet.
Yeah.
It's hard to separate how it looks in this reproduction as the actual cover that we know in our heads.
That's also what I should say. So this is a scan from Mike's Amazing World. So maybe when it was printed in the book, it did look better. Mm-hmm. Even my copy, you can kind of see what's on the other side of the page.
All right. Best debut or first issue? Easy one.
10,000% easy. Super Friends.
Yeah, I don't think we had another debut of a character or a number one, if my memory serves.
Unless this would have been the month that Deadman or Man Bat debuted. It doesn't matter because Super Friends would have been number one.
Fair enough. That was easy. The best comic you've read from this month.
Ooh, okay, so not Freedom Fighters.
I think we should change this. Instead of best, maybe we should say favorite.
It could be best and favorite. So.
Could be best and favorite. Yeah.
I would say I don't want to turn traitor against the Titans. But I kind of think the Action Comics Superman story.
Absolutely. Yeah, Luthor churning Superman. That's my vote as well. Yeah. Titans was an early favorite of mine too, but objectively, you know, those stories aren't the greatest, I have to say. But this Superman story is a fun romp, without question.
Yeah.
And then the last one is the comic that you don't have or haven't read, but now after reading all this, you want to read.
I am going to shock you because it's going to be Plop.
Oh, that's not a shock. That's what I would have picked too.
Oh, good.
I was thinking maybe it was the Tarzan family one, but I want to read that Plop story, you know?
But again, that's because I have Titans. I have JLA.
Yeah, well, we have a lot of these, but yeah. All right. Good month.
Fantastic month. Happy summer. That's it for this segment. Next month, we will, of course, have your reporter feedback. So please leave us some at fireandwaterpodcast.com.
All right, moving on to our next episode announcement. In September, I will be making my first foray into four-star spectacular. In particular, I'll be covering issue number 4 with stories about Wonder Woman, Superboy, and Hawkman and Hawkgirl. I will be joined by my brother-in-law, Todd Sarenbetz, right here in the DC Special Cast studio. And of course, Sean and I will be moving on to September 1976 with The Monthly Planet. So look for it on Sunday, September 6th, the day before Labor Day. Getting on to our feedback. So you may recall I recorded feedback for episode 18 about Supergirl with my guest Dr. Ange early last month due to my vacation. And a few comments came in after I recorded it, so I do want to be able to read them now. From Gotham's Mansion, as always, another entertaining show. I always enjoy it. The Daily Planet feature is a lot of fun too. I do think it could be spun off into its own show. Since you guys mentioned how much plot was crammed into the stories, I'm going to say I think that is why I can't stand the glacial pacing of modern comics. The comics I grew up on gave me more story and fewer pages. You probably already knew, but this story reprinted here from Action 298 got the cover of that issue over the Superman story. Lex punches out a Superman statue, so Superman is still on the cover instead of Supergirl, though. As for Supergirl, do you guys ever wonder if some of DC's artists designed some of Supergirl's outfits instead of fans? I'm surprised so many ladies contributed, probably because I've only known a couple of ladies that read comics. One of Supergirl's skimpiest outfits, the one she had on the cover of Adventure 409, was listed as designed by a female reader. I really would have thought only a guy could have come up with that suit. Gothos, I hear you, and I agree for the most part, and I don't know the genesis of that particular outfit you reference, but I do know that a lot more girls and kids overall read comics back in the 1950s and 60s, right? Just look at the volume of romance comics. They didn't really die out till the 70s. Just a thought. I don't know. Back to Gotham's Mansion. My favorite Supergirl costume is the 70s blouse with the pocket S-shield, but with boots instead of the ballet slippers. I also really like the 80s outfit that debuted in Supergirl 13th, at least before she added the headband. A question here, though. For the nude Supergirl commissions from Jim Mooney, how could one identify that the art was indeed Supergirl? Did he leave her cape or something on to give her a distinguishing characteristic? Otherwise, couldn't she just be a random pretty blonde? Sorry to ask such a pervy question. To which Ann promptly replied, the ones he sent in were in a changing room, so the uniform was on the ground or streaky was hanging around. You knew it was Supergirl. Guys, thanks for all that pervy info. Back to comments. Brett Young, network all-star and host of the Fantastic Four, said, great episode as always. Ange is becoming the fire and water equivalent of the fifth Beatle. Silver Age Supergirl stories are always ridiculous in the best way. From Cleopatra getting screwed out of first place at a costume ball, unwanted advances from crew cuts, to a multi-use thought control machine that also teleports, that's better than my toaster oven. You guys really sold the fun. Terrific history lesson on Jim Mooney. Glad he was still working full-time into his late 50s. Gritty groovy costume design for Supergirl. But why didn't they just have a static pose and have Supergirl wearing the outfits? They kind of get lost in the psychedelic backgrounds. Like you guys, I'm hopeful for the new movie. I thought Millie Alcock was great in House of the Dragon, so I'm confident she'll hit the pitch. Thanks, Brett. And moving on to this month's comments about episode 19 covering DC Special number 29, The Untold Origin of the JSA with the Irredeemable Shag. Over on social media, we got a comment from Stephen Shend, who said, I really enjoyed the DC Special cast on the JSA Origin by Paul and Shag. Glad for the spotlight on Joe Staton and his work. I had a chance to thank him long ago for his exemplary first comics classics illustrated adaption of A Christmas Carol. Thanks, Stephen. I love that too. I still have it, and I used to read it to my kids Christmas time. And even cooler, listener John Stibe had reposted the episode into the JSA Facebook group, and Joe Staten himself left a comment. Joe said, "Anybody who has any interest in the background of the Justice Society really should listen to this podcast, which covers it all. And, which I don't get to say often, the guys who do the podcast have a really sweet approach. Thanks, guys." Wow, that was awesome. Thank you, Joe, for your kind words. Listeners, I do hope to have Joe on for an interview, but no promises until it happens. But stay tuned to our feed. Now to comments from our website, fireandwaterpodcast.com. First up, as he often is, Ido Bosnar said, "Excellent show, Paul and Shag. I had this issue back in the day, and like you guys, I just loved it. The story, the art, the buxom Valkyries, everything. And by the way, since it's even featured on the cover, I should note that the Spear of Destiny actually exists, although it's better known as the Holy Lance. There are, in fact, four artifacts, one in Vienna, another in Rome, and I forget where the other two are, which are purportedly the weapon used to pierce Christ's heart. To my knowledge, though, none have exhibited any supernatural power. Anyway, I appreciated the spotlight on Joe Staten, as he has always been a personal favorite of mine, although I think you could have put a little more emphasis on E-Man, which is one of the most brilliant characters created in the 1970s. And also, a note, the surname of E-Man's other co-creator, Nicola Cuddy, is pronounced like Cuddy, as it rhymes with buddy. Don't be bad about not knowing that, because until I heard it pronounced correctly, I read it as Cootie in my head. And Shag is right. Showcase 100 is an absolute standout, and I'd argue it's the best 100th issue of a series ever. And in conclusion, I have to respond to a comment you made in the Monthly Planet feature about Swamp Thing going to Portland for some craft beer. As someone who grew up about 30 miles south of the city, I can tell you unequivocally that back in the late 70s, that would have been highly unlikely. The best Swamp he could have gotten was a bottle of Henry Weinhard's, the premium beer produced by a local Blitz brewery. Portland only began to become a haven for hipsters with a penchant for craft beers in the very tail end of the 1980s. Thanks, Ido. Great stuff. Appreciate the comments. Past guest, and fifth beetle, I guess, to the Fire and Water Network, Dr. Ange says, "I love this book. I know I got it signed by Joe Staten, but I think it was a, quote, top secret project. Maybe I sent it to Chris Franklin? Anyway, the Spectre ripping up boats and Superman bashing through planes and the Atom saving FDR, all those things live rent-free in my mind. And, of course, the buxom Valkyries live there, too. As for Shag being upset about FDR creating all the teams, I will remind him that Roy Thomas co-created FDR and can do whatever he wants for the character." Thanks, Dr. Ange. But Chris Franklin promptly replied, "Sadly, I wasn't recipient of the signed DC Special 29, so the search continues." Next up, Mark Bigger Wright gives us some education. "Sorry, Paul, but you're 100 years off the mark. The sesquicentennial was the 150th anniversary. This year was the semi-quincentennial for the 250th anniversary of the founding of the USA. Thanks, Mark. I have struggled with that word all year. I typed it wrong into my notes and just plowed ahead, so I appreciate you setting everybody straight." Next up, Chuck Coletta says, "I really enjoyed this episode, guys. One quick note on Joe Staten. I've been a big Dick Tracy fan since I was a kid. Several years ago, when Joe was still drawing the comic strip, he attended a comic convention in my area. He was signing lots of superhero comics, and I think I surprised him by asking him to autograph a Dick Tracy poster. He jumped up and asked if he could take my photograph. I'm guessing not many Tracy fans went to conventions. His work on Dick Tracy was fantastic and won several awards. I hope it gets collected." Yeah, that'd be cool, Chuck. You know, hopefully we'll see that. Another past guest, Movie Matt Saroyce, says, "A great episode about a great comic, one of my absolute all-time favorite comics. I also have mine signed by both Levitz and Staten, also at the Baltimore Comic Con. Does the book treat our heroes like Trump? Well, sure, they kind of were chumps. They were rookies in the winter of 1940. Some of them haven't even had time to drip coffee on their costumes, and they were going up against battle-hardened troops that had been sweeping through Europe. It's not too hard to accept they'd get their clocks cleaned in the beginning. I kind of agree with Shag that Batman and Superman probably should have been left out of the story, especially since they weren't part of the original JSA Adventures. However, this book was a big celebration of DC's Golden Age heroes. It would have been a shame to leave them out. The comic is pure magic. I love it. Every page, every panel. No argument from me, Matt." Next up, we get Super Captain. He says, "Kind of funny to hear Shag talking about the JSA in a podcast that he doesn't host. I might have had the digest version of the story, but I'm not sure. But I'll definitely be looking for it now. That Superman splash page alone would be worth the price. I have had the opportunity to meet Joe Staten, too, a few times at Heroes Con. He and his wife could not be nicer people. I got a photo of myself and him and All-Star Comics number 72, which was my first JSA comic. He kindly signed it, as well as my Showcase 100 and his issue of the DC Challenge. There's a whole class of items called the Arma Christi, or the weapons of Christ, that are associated with his passion. The Spear of Destiny / Holy Lance, as Ido Bosnar mentions above, is one of them, along with the Holy Grail, the Crown of Thorns, and other relics. And I just wanted to say that I also love the Daily Planet feature and have been making my way through all the back episodes of Batman Family Reunion. This show continues that tradition of excellence. Wow, thanks, Super Captain. That's really kind of you to say. Next up, film historian and CEO of Vintage Cinema Revisited, Rob Kelly, says, I was able to set aside my festering jealousy that Shag got to cover this comic, always one of my all-time favorites. I first read this story in Best of DC Digest number 21, and the simple, clear penciling of Joe Staton combined with Bob Layton's super smooth, clean inks really reduced Downton well. I wish they had been paired together more as they really complement each other. I've always had an affinity for 30s and 40s America. That probably comes from a couple of different sources, but one of them is undoubtedly stories like this, with all the period flavor and FDR being such a total badass. He created the JSA, for Pete's sake. Regarding the Monthly Planet, the Welcome Back Cotter Treasury is, in fact, all new material, made up of issues commissioned for the regular book, which got canceled before they ran. I wish DC had used the treasuries for more of that kind of material. The DC implosion alone could have gifted us half a dozen more all-new collector's editions. Thanks, Rob. Appreciate the info about Cotter. That makes a lot of sense. Next up, network fashionista Lizanne Oswald said, impressive podcast, most impressive, cool cover, and it is well put together, drawing your eye to the title of the book. Decent enough splash page of the whole JSA. Power Girl is one of my favorites. Flash and Green Lantern fighting the giant Nazi robot was indeed cool. The Valkyries are pretty cool too, and I swear that's not me and one of my girlfriends, Danielle, flying in. LOL, I wish. And the Atom to the rescue, not a bad save. I can't wait for the next episode. Thanks, Lizanne. Past and future guest and host of the Supermates and Batman Nightcast, Chris Franklin, says, still making my way through the episode, but I wanted to comment on the DC special portion first. Like others here, I first encountered this story in Best of DC Digest number 21. I will forever remember that issue because I got in trouble in school, but my mom didn't know it, and I brought that book home. When I told her, rather than take it away from me, she told me to remember what I did every time I look at that book, and I still do. Despite this, I love this comic, and I think it's a perfect origin for the JSA. The Superman splash helps cement my love for the Earth 2 version of the character, which is one reason I'm doing the Mr. and Mrs. Superman series. There are some oddities like Sandman throwing sand and not using his gas gun, but minor niggles aside, it's a stone-cold classic, and you guys gave it its due. The spotlight on Joe Staton was fantastic, and others have said he couldn't be another fellow to meet at cons. What a fantastic body of work he's produced. So glad he got some love from last year's Superman movie. Very well deserved. His giant bat symbol, favorite of many, helped influence Alex Ross's take on Batman's costume, so his legacy runs deep. And aside from Shag's slight diss on Earth 2 Robin's, quote, goofy costume, Shag, have you seen his earlier Batman-esque number? This was a fantastic episode, gents. Now onto the Monthly Planet. Thanks, Chris. Appreciate it. Past guest, an all-around great guy, Martin Gray, says, and it's another splendid episode. Thanks, Paul and Shag. I remember being so excited when this issue came out. I mean, it's the never-before-revealed origin of the Justice Society. Did you notice that both the Justice League and Justice Society had origins that were untold until they were told in double-sided issues? And both of them in the summer of 1977. Yeah, it's a great coincidence, Martin. I didn't realize that. That's pretty cool. I wonder why the colon was added to the DC special on the cover. Yeah, I'm a bit of a stickler for grammar and stuff, but even then, I think that was unnecessary. You know, Martin, I have seen it before, but never really, quote, noticed it. But now it is definitely an eyesore. I agree. It is a classic cover from Neil Adams, Martin said. It goes on. He says, but it is a bit too cluttered. I'd at least taken off the side swastika from the rocket and maybe the odd Valkyrie. But isn't it typical that the final pinup where the group is together, Superman and Batman are so prominent, but they were never regular members? It's so weird that Showcase 100 has never been reprinted in English. Maybe we could do some FW podcast manifesting. Okay, I'll work on it right now, Martin, but I do think that'd be a great comic for a facsimile edition. Back to Martin. Love the Joe Staton profile. What a prolific creator. Do you think the two Red Tornado heads on the splash were apparently so carelessly placed because neither one deserved to be there? I mean, Ma Hunkle was delusional and Reddy was brainwashed into thinking he was a member. And as ever, an excellent addition to the Monthly Planet. I'd forgotten that early on Bob Rozakis used to write the featured previews as he was an actual newspaper with witnesses to superhero incidents, etc. I'm glad he dropped that. That was a little too cheesy. And the reason you don't remember what Hawkman was doing in Portland, Paul, is that Swamp Thing number 25 was never published because the comic was canceled. Pages from the story were printed in Swamp Thing the Bronze Age number 2. And if you ask Google Gemini, it hallucinates that, quote, a fully finished and completed version of this issue was released as part of the Swamp Thing Dark Genesis Omnibus Collection. Thanks so much for the call out, as if I'm always correcting you, Paul. Paul, surely you're wrong on who canceled Warlord. It wouldn't be Julie Schwartz. It would be Carmine Infantino. Absolutely right, Martin. I misspoke on that. And the Black Canary story with the calculator referencing the old song, "It'll Be a Hot Time in the Old Town Tonight," has been referenced so many times by comic book writers. Do any of us even know this song? I don't. That's a good one. And Woman 226 and 227 were my favorite issues of the Bronze Age, as well as the usual Ace Art from Jose Delbo. It has a touching script from Marty Pasco. Two words, Sean. Judy Garland. We never got Welcome Back, Kotter on TV in the UK, but I did like the comic well enough. And those Daily Planet quizzes were always so simple. We should make up our own. Heck, I dreamed of a Fire and Water podcast trivia quiz show. All great comments, Martin. I appreciate you keeping me straight. And the info on the Bronze Age Swamp Thing was excellent. Next up, Matthew Davis. A longtime JSA fan, this issue is one of my favorites. I run hot and cold on Joe Staton. I remember his work on the $6 Million Man comic for Charlton and loved his work when paired with Bob Layton. Somehow his cartoony style doesn't seem like it always fit this story or character, but when it does, it's great. Matthew, some of those $6 Million Man comics and magazines were great. Good call out. I'm also a history buff and fan of alternative histories. This episode's story summary collided with that part of me and got me to wondering. FDR has just been reelected for his third term in November 1940. The VP at that time, John Nance Garner, had challenged FDR for the nomination, as was subsequently replaced on the ticket by Henry Wallace, the Secretary of Agriculture. This story is still about a month away from the electors meeting to cast their votes, and 2 months away from Congress certifying the results, and FDR and Wallace being sworn in January 20th, 1941. If the Valkyrie had killed FDR, then Garner would have become president. The big what if is, what happens to FDR's Electoral College voters? Do they vote for Wallace? Does Garner make an argument for himself? He's been VP for 8 years, was a former House Speaker, is now the incumbent president. If the Democratic votes split and goes to the House, who does the House select? Crap, just what I need, a new rabbit hole for me pulling my head in. Hang in there, Matthew, you'll be all right. I can see it now. What if the Atom failed to save FDR? Hope you get some sleep tonight, Matthew. Next up, past guest John Stibe says, "This was a fantastic episode of DC Special Cast as usual, and I'm not just saying that because I started and I think I finished the comment section. This is a fun show because of the variety of specials that Paul picks, how much work he puts into each episode, and his creator spotlight info, because of what his guests bring to the table, and because of the Monthly Planet. I sometimes forget that it's coming up, and I think, wow, the comment section must be huge this month because there's still 50 minutes to go or whatever. I read every one of these Daily Planets back in the day, and I wish I could find some of those comics on the spinner rack, the local small town pharmacies where I bought comics. I never even saw books like Warlord or Commandy, and probably wouldn't have enough money to buy them anyway. But it was so cool to see all the things that DC was publishing. I also agree with Martin that the trivia was way too simple, even for me back then. But thanks for another entertaining show, Paul and Shag." Well, thank you, John. Bucky749 got in under the wire and says, "Zoinks! I almost forgot to leave a comment. I've been on vacation. Story looks cool. I have read some comics set during World War II, but I always seem to find Marvel stuff like the Invaders or All Winter Squad. Anyway, here's a secret question. Who's your favorite member of the JSA? I'll probably be the only one who picks Johnny as Thunderbolt. I'm sure that Johnny is secretly Jimmy Olsen's long-lost uncle." Thanks, Bucky. Network hostess with the most is Brett Young. "Great show, Paul, another guy. I first read this JSA origin in a digest, and it'll always be one of those stories that stuck with me. Such a cool way to handle such a large array of superheroes. Everyone pretty much had their moment. And regarding Sandman not being visible on the cover, while most of the heroes went high to take on the Valkyries, we've learned from the Sandman Mystery Theater that Wes especially was going low. Bada bing." To which Martin replied, "That's not a little naughty, Brett." And finally, guest of that very episode, the irredeemable Shag, says, "Such a blast recording this. Thanks again for having me on the show, Paul. Since recording this episode, I've had the opportunity to return to Heroes Con and chat again with Joe Staton. I bought an original Dr. Fate head sketch from him this time, and he and his wife shared with me tales of their love for Doctor Who. Joe Staton is a fan of Doctor Who and had funny stories of meeting two of the actors who have played the Doctor. Doctor Who and Joe Staton, two of my favorite things." Very cool. And Super Captain even added, "Shaggy noticed that Joe was wearing a TARDIS baseball cap at Heroes Con. Glad to know he's a fan. Just another reason to appreciate him." Well, that's it for the comments this month. Thank you, everybody who wrote in. It means a lot to me, and I enjoy reading and responding to your comments. As always, please leave comments on the show post on our website, fireandwaterpodcast.com. A reminder that if you're enjoying what you hear on this show or any of the other network shows, please consider becoming a patron to help defray the cost. At certain levels, you can get a call out on the show of your choice or suggest an episode to the network. This episode's special thanks go out to our Sunday supporters, Al the Comics Guy, David Gutierrez, Gord Tolton, Mike Atchison, He's my guest from this very episode. To find out more, go to patreon.com/FWPodcast and thanks. That'll do it for the feedback section and for the episode. Special thanks to Mike Atchison for being on the show. Check out his podcast for sure. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll join me and Todd next month as we discuss 4-Star Spectacular #4.